It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. A big night on the program. A bunch of guests. Dr. Joel Yudkin is going to be here talking about our manufacturing policy, the crisis this nation is in right now, since it is Manufacturing Monday. We're also going to talk to Rich Michalski, General Vice President of the International Association of Machinists, about the big Boeing decisions, which I think, you know, it's granted it's just the general counsel's opinion. It's his decision right now. It's going to go on through the process. But right now, this is a huge, huge decision to say that workers in this country have the right to strike, which is the law. But to actually have someone stand up and say, it's the law, we're going to enforce it. That, to me, is a huge, huge decision. Also, Paul Quinn, professor at Kutztown University, going to be here talking about the big rally going to happen tomorrow here as students from across the state come to Harrisburg to say, you know what, Governor Corporate? Invest in the future. Invest in us. Don't cut 56% of the higher education budget. In fact, don't cut the $1 billion you're going to take from K through 12. Don't destroy the future of the kids in this state. You know, we keep hearing this ridiculous nonsense that, well, you know, we got all these kids who they leave. Well, they leave because schools out of state help them. They leave because there's opportunity here. How about trying some of that here? Maybe start looking at closing the Delaware loophole. Maybe, just maybe, start looking at taxing the Marcellus shale drillers. There would be a good start. Now, also, Serena Fedora, she's going to be here talking about the great budget bake sale that happened today. A mother and concerned citizen going to be talking about how many cookies would it cost to fill Governor Corporate's budget? How many cookies do we have to sell to restore the funding to education so that her children, mine, yours, all the kids of Pennsylvania have an opportunity to get an education without slashing and burning? Because really, this is the Republican scorched earth. This is their MO. This is what they do. Also, Mike Elk, an author, writer over at The Nation and a whole bunch of other places. He's going to be here talking about his piece, Big Brother's Thought Control at Coke. You can see that over at thenation.com. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Hope everybody had a good holiday weekend. I know we did. USA Today had a piece that just grabbed my attention, and it's one of these things I have to absolutely get to. Now look what's going on in Ohio. Like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like a lot of states where you have a Republican-controlled Senate, Republican-controlled House, and a Republican governor, where Republicans basically run the table. There's no opposition in those states. None. Nothing. Zip. Zilch. Republicans are just going to steamroll whatever they want, which, you know, I don't care if you're a Republican or whatever. You cannot be happy with that kind of mass control. You can't be. It's not good for democracy. It's not good for a nation. What we end up seeing is we end up seeing this massive overreach, and we're seeing it. Republicans right now are way, way overreaching. And that's a good thing, because I think you're going to see the electric swing back, the electric swing back the other way, and we'll see some balance. But what caught my eye in this piece at USA Today, it's titled, If You Build It, Will They Come? It's talking about Ohio. Now, understand, you've got free market people, the free market Republican capitalists, you know, the invisible hand, government's the problem, not the solution. You let the free market decide, let industry run itself. These kind of Republicans in charge of what's going on in Ohio. Understand that. So USA Today points out the fact that in a place called Van Wert, Ohio, there's 1,600 acres of farmland that the state of Ohio has purchased. It's now a speculative industrial site. They've added rail lines, gas lines, all this stuff. It's all going to be there for hopefully somebody to come. And whyvanwert.org is the website if you want to check that out. You know, they're planning this big industrial site. Now, understand, they're going to put rail lines in for business, not for their people. Kasich's already said no rail for you, but for business, we'll work on that. And what's interesting, what USA Today said is Ohio has launched what appears to be the biggest intervention in the private economy by a state government since at least the Great Depression. Think about this for a second. The biggest intervention in the private economy since the Great Depression. These are the free market. Government's the problem, not the solution. Get out of the way of business. Republicans who have pushed this idea that, well, you know, we're gonna let business do what they want to do. Which, you know, I'm not all opposed to. They're gonna spend $1.4 billion. Ohio is going to spend $1.4 billion on this economic development wish, hope, and prayer. Now you look at states like Indiana, they're going to spend about $37 million. Florida is going to spend $11 million. California has about 25 people working on economic development. Ohio has more than 400. Here in this state, they've talked about paring back what we're doing. But what you've got here is you've got, again, these aren't free market people. These aren't conservatives who are running this. These, I hate to use the word, these are fascists. These are corporatists. These are puppets. And USA Today asked the question, can government direct the economy into the future? Or is that done by a free market? But it's interesting. I mean, if you look at it, the Republicans who have time and time again touted this great invisible hand, the market will decide. We need free market principles. Hear it all the time. But yet they're spending $1.4 billion trying to influence this. Now, look, Ohio's lost over a half a million jobs in the past decade. And what they're saying is about 80% of those half million jobs were decent, good-paying union manufacturing jobs. Only Michigan's had more job loss than Ohio, especially in the manufacturing economy, which is what we're going to focus on a little bit later on in the program. But if you look at what USA Today looked at, Ohio's going to spend $1.4 billion. What are you going to get for it? And Ohio and USA Today looked at a two dozen projects that Ohio funded, and they found that many of them were either way behind or failed to deliver the jobs as promised, which we see time and time again. So they're going to spend this $1.4 billion. They're going to steal it from education. They're going to steal it from investing in the future of their kids so that they can hand it to private corporations. Like this hope and dream of this company that wants to make synthetic natural gas. They've given $70 million to. It's been in the works for more than a decade. Still, nothing. They've spent $70 million. Hasn't worked. There's another site. You know, there's several of these sites that they've decided we're going to make these industrial parks. And hopefully the car companies and the big manufacturers, hopefully they'll choose Ohio instead of Tennessee or Alabama, because we got to get into the big cash game. We got to get into the game where we hand out the big, big cardboard checks and businesses come and say, yes, we want your money. Now, other places have tried this. Michigan tried it. It didn't work. Michigan is now trying to figure out how to lower their taxes to almost nothing in hopes that somebody will then come, shifting all of that responsibility that businesses used to play, paying property tax and employment tax and all that stuff, onto the backs of the income earners, the people who work for a living. And what I find interesting is even the free market people who believe in this stuff are saying, well, this is not such a great idea. You know, the whole tax thing, not such a great idea. Maybe we should just stay out of it, make a level playing field. Kind of what I've been saying for years. Create a level playing field across the country so that every company decides on education, infrastructure, location, not on who's got the biggest cardboard check. And this Ohio State University economist said that a tax incentive from one firm means I have to raise taxes on everyone else or cut services, which is what's going on. You're going to raise taxes on the other businesses, so you give handouts to these folks, and we're cutting education. Now, this is a state that is devastated. Ohio's been devastated by foreign competition. I mean, that's not even talking about the state competition where Tennessee or Arkansas or Alabama take work away. It has nothing to do. Internationally, they've been getting creamed. And back in November, when Kasich was running, and this is what bothers me. This is what bothers me about voters in this country. One of the exit polls that they did in Ohio asked the question, what's your thought of free trade? And by a 7-to-1 ratio, people said that they didn't like the free trade agreements and that free trade had taken jobs away from Ohio. 7-to-1 understood that. Yet they voted for John Kasich, who voted no on withdrawing from the WTO, voted yes for fast-track authority for trade agreements, basically giving the president the right to, sure, we're going to sign right off on that. Abdicating Congress's responsibility. He voted in favor of NAFTA, was all for, in fact, one of the key people pushing NAFTA. He was one of the guys who pushed permanent normal trade relations with China. Voted for tax breaks that corporations can take as they move jobs overseas. You know, voted against giving workers advance notice when being laid off. Has even said that unions threaten our American values. Yet they voted for this guy. And now I guess some people are surprised that this is his position. So you're looking at $1.4 billion. $1.4 billion. That doesn't even take into account the other tax breaks and the other programs that the state has. That's just, here's $1.4 billion that we stole from the workers, that we stole from children's futures, and we're going to hand it out, we're going to dish it out to our corporate buddies. What I find amazing is they're privatizing this whole economic development thing. They have this thing called Jobs Ohio, and it's this quasi-private public operation. Who knows where it is, but it's basically accountable to almost no one. And what Kasich has said is he hopes that by making this private entity, it's going to get the money out there faster. It's going to act faster and more efficiently. And more effectively. And what I find interesting is, to me, what you're saying is you're going to give the money away faster to your campaign contributors and get no results for the citizens at all. And I think of the nearly $100 million they handed over to American Greetings and the more than $50 million they handed over to Diebold there in Ohio. And I go, there you go. It explains it right there in a nutshell. The idea, though, that they have is they want to be. And the article talks about what Stanford University did with Google and how Stanford was able to make a bunch of money off of licensing with Google. And they say, well, why can't the state of Ohio do that? Because you don't gamble like that. They're talking about taking the $100 million that they expect from liquor profits, and they're going to gamble that. That's going to go into more of this beggar thy neighbor economic development. And one of the things that really grabbed my attention, basically they're handing out money as fast as they can. And they're handing out taxes money as fast as they can. It doesn't matter what you do, they're going to have some money for you. One of the things that they came up with, and this is something that absolutely infuriates me. They pay city and county tax in Ohio. And so you've got an employer who pays this, and an employee who pays this into the municipal funds. And they collect it, and they give half of it back to the company. So you're paying your taxes, figuring, well, I'm paying my taxes to help make sure my local municipality is taken care of. They take half of that money, and they give it back to the company as a location award. Explain to me where that's good policy. Explain to me how that's going to help build our future when all you're doing is handing money back to these big corporations. Procter & Gamble, and this is the last thing before we take a break. Procter & Gamble got $250,000 to pave a parking lot. Explain to me how that $250,000 to pave that parking lot is benefiting the kids of Cleveland or Columbus or Cincinnati or any of the towns in Cleveland with their education when you're stealing more than $1 billion from them. Makes no sense. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with our good friend Mike Elk. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers are rallying in San Francisco today to defend ILWU Local 10 against a lawsuit filed by the Pacifica Maritime Association.
An injury to one is an injury to all. That ILWU slogan is at the heart of today's rally in San Francisco. ILWU Local 10 shut down the Port of Oakland for 24 hours April 4th in solidarity with Wisconsin workers. The ILWU hung a banner with that slogan in Wisconsin's state capitol during the historic labor protests there. The Pacific Maritime Association is suing ILWU Local 10 for its solidarity action. The San Francisco Labor Council's Tim Paulson.
This is an attack on Local 10 for supporting the workers in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest of the United States against the attacks on collective bargaining and workers' rights. And we're urging people to stop down with brothers and sisters in Local 10 and protest this lawsuit.
The San Francisco Labor Council unanimously passed a resolution supporting ILWU Local 10. The rally today will demand that the Pacific Maritime Association drop its lawsuit against the local.
Coverage of the ongoing protests in Wisconsin against Governor Scott Walker have mostly been focused in the state capital of Madison. However, that's not the only place where state legislators who voted for the union-busting legislation are feeling the heat of taxpayers. Listening sessions throughout the state are having echoes of the raucous healthcare town halls in 2009. In the town of Lake Haley in northwestern Wisconsin on Tuesday night, Republican State Senator Terry Moulton and Republican State Representative Kathy Bernier took part in a tense listening session where they were mostly criticized for siding with the governor. One woman asked the legislators to come to the schools and meet the people that will be impacted by the cuts.
I would ask that you please come to our schools and meet our students and meet our staff and truly know who you are impacting.
A number of participants said they had sent letters and made phone calls to those representatives, but received no response. The representatives responded that they received thousands of emails and it would be difficult to respond to every one. One woman who did receive a response from both of the legislators said she was unimpressed.
Over the past 2 months, I've protested, I've emailed, and I've telephoned both of you. The responses I received were very disappointing. I received an email from Representative Bernier and a letter from Senator Moulton. In each, I was talked at, I was talked down to, and I felt like it was nothing but a big circle.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, well, that's what they do evidently at Koch Industries. Evidently, that not only do they want to watch you, evidently they want to tell you what to think. I guess the question is, how would you respond if your boss told you who you had to vote for? How would you respond if your boss told you your job was on the line? You had to think a certain way or vote a certain way. I'm sure by now everyone's heard of Charles and David Koch, the billionaire brothers who have really taken lobbying and political influence to that next level since Citizens United. In his latest piece, Big Brother's Thought Control at Koch, Mike Elk tells how the Wonder Twins have used their power to influence the voting people in their companies. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how's it going, Rick?
I'm good. You know, looking at this piece that you wrote, I guess, are we seeing right-wing talk radio propaganda being mandated in the workplace?
Yeah, Citizens United has created a whole new era where now you can have captive audience meetings and give out slick literature to workers right in the workplace that boss can.
Explain what a captive audience meeting is to those who may not know.
It's a meeting where your boss comes in and talks to you about politics or an anti-union organizing drive. And if you don't attend, you can be fired from your job.
And what if you stand up and say, I don't agree with you?
Well, you know, that creates a very difficult situation because, you know, in 49 states in this country, you can be fired at will, meaning you can be fired for anything.
Just like here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, unless you have a union contract or something like that that protects you. You can be fired for anything. So in those kind of situations, you create a situation in which you politicize the workplace and you create the conditions for political discrimination. You know, imagine if your boss is wearing a button that says, oh, you know, vote GOP. What if you're not wearing a button at work? Does that mean you don't get an A? You know, you don't get a raise? What if, you know, your boss is encouraging everybody to go down and volunteer for the local Republican candidate and you're not going down, and you hadn't gone down and volunteered as well? Does that mean that you won't get a raise as well?
Yeah, to me, it goes back to the days when public employees, much where Republicans take us back to the good old days of patronage, where public employees were at the whim of the political winds, where, you know, if a Republican came in, it was all the Republican appointees, and if a Democrat came in, it was all the Democrats, and there was, you know, the taxpayer be damned, but it was this patronage system.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's exactly the kind of conditions that we're creating. I mean, the National Labor Relations Act outlawed this. FDR spoke out against this practice specifically and said it was something that only desperate employers do when they don't have any other way of getting people to believe in their ideas.
But so, since the Roberts Court came up with this decision, this Citizens United decision, which, again, I think everybody, virtually everybody agrees is not in keeping with how the law has been over the last 100 years, has really changed things in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Citizens United has given a corporation a full First Amendment rights, meaning that, you know, it's overturned Gissel versus the, you know, Gissel Packing House, the Supreme Court case, where they said, you know, having an employer tell you to do something by its very nature is an unfair situation. It's given full First Amendment rights now to corporations, and corporations can do anything they want to an employee and put an employee in a threatening political situation.
So let me ask you this, and this is something that I've had someone ask me. What do you say to those who say Koch and other employees or other employers should have the ability, you know, to send out newsletters, to have these meetings, you know, about candidates' positions and how those positions may affect the company, you know, hold educational meetings, if you will. What do you say to that?
I say, you know, it's a real threat to our democracy anytime somebody has the power to fire you. Is telling you that your job is potentially threatened if you don't vote a certain way. I think it's a real threat to our democracy. I mean, you know, you put somebody in a very difficult situation, you can create the conditions in which political discrimination can occur.
So given that we've seen the Koch brothers do this, and I'm sure there are others, is it safe to say that other employers are going to roll out these tactics as we move to 2012?
Yeah, I mean, the Koch brothers, Lee Fang, I think Progress, unearthed a memo from one of the Koch brothers' top political operatives who said, you know, we need to find ways to use our employees to push our political messages more. So I think it could happen. And the thing about the Koch brothers, why they're important, is they've always sort of been the leaders of the right-wing movement among business leaders. They, you know, they have conferences twice a year. They coordinate things. They've always been heavily into coordinating. This goes well back to their father, who was involved in, you know, the John Birch Society. So right. They've been around for decades doing this, and they understand the importance of coordination, political coordination.
And you look at the amount of money that they've spent in lobbying, the amount of money they've put into the Tea Party with Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works and those groups, and it's no wonder we have seen the shift in voter consciousness, if you will.
Yeah, I mean it's absolutely amazing the shift that we've seen in voter consciousness over the last 20 years, because they can just spend unlimited funds. I mean, look what happened in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race where the Koch brothers came in and spent $400,000 in the last several weeks of the election.
You quote Travis McKinney in your piece.
Mm-hmm.
He's an employee at the Portland, Georgia Pacific Distribution Center. He said they drill into your head things like the 10 guiding principles of Koch Industries. They even stamp the 10 principles on your time card. To me, is that not a hostile work environment?
Well, it's incredibly hostile work environment where your boss is constantly lecturing you and telling you how to think. I mean, you create conditions in which people are going to speak up. And what if you speak up and you don't agree with your boss? Then your boss has a reason to fire you.
You know, I wonder, and I've asked a couple of conservative friends what they would think if their employer put a rainbow on their paycheck, how they would react. And they weren't too thrilled with the idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I think there's an opportunity here for folks to wake up and realize that the workplace should be non-political.
Mm-hmm.
But these folks, these Koch brothers, they've got a lot of money and they can respond. And they've responded to your piece, I understand.
Yeah, they responded and they basically said, yeah, everything that Elks and Ames said we did, and it's legal.
And they've got the kind of money to back up, to go after anybody. If you look at CokeFacts.com, they do an awful lot of going after and rewriting history.
Yeah, but the thing in our case is they issued a simple two-paragraph response, simply saying, yeah, we did that. We don't agree that it's intimidating, but yeah, we did that. And, you know, let people decide for themselves if they want their boss holding captive audience meetings with you. Let people decide that themselves, and I think people know that that would be a threatening situation.
What kind of response have you gotten from readers on this?
An astronomical response. People are outraged.
Do you think people were surprised by how easy and how free employers are to do things so blatantly?
I think people are absolutely shocked. I mean, you know, who could imagine potentially being fired from their job for what you think politically? I mean, this is supposed to be America, where everybody's supposed to be able to cast their vote without fear of, actions being taken against them.
So wouldn't you think this would be a situation where unions could step in and say, we have the ability to put some of this to rest and to add some balance?
Yeah, and I think unions could do that. And I think, you know, the worker that spoke out is a member of the Longshoremen's Union, and he was able to do that because he doesn't have to worry about, getting fired from his job because he's a member of a union, and the union can protect him in these types of situations.
You know, because I look at this, and, you know, and when I talk to people about being at your workplace, that to me should be about being at work and being able to support your family, and to throw something like this in the middle of it, where the survival of your family and your children and your livelihood is based on what somebody thinks that you may or you may not do. To me, I just think it's dangerous to have that kind of power in the hands of people like the Koch brothers.
Certainly.
Mike, it's a great piece. It's over at thenation.com. It's called Koch Brothers Thought Control at Coke, or Big Brothers Thought Control at Coke. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Mike, I appreciate your time and keep up the great work.
Okay, sounds good.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In case you missed it, America just celebrated its National Day of Irony, April 22nd. The irony is that this date is not only Earth Day, but also happens to be the day that BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig sank into the Gulf of Mexico 1 year ago. If a novelist or movie scriptwriter juxtaposed the date of a hellish environmental catastrophe with that of a day when thousands of Americans gathered to celebrate and promote environmental protection, the plot would be hooted down as a cheap attempt to manufacture drama. Reality, however, has a way of creating its own ironies, and the BP Earth Day convergence was not the only one of April 22nd. Just 1 week prior, the corporate-hugging House of Representatives chose to demonstrate its commitment to Earth's fragile ecology by passing the GOP's extremist budget plan. Included were provisions to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate corporations that emit the greenhouse gases causing today's disastrous climate changes. But that wasn't extreme enough. The plan also slashed EPA's budget, leaving our Earth and ourselves to the tender mercies of corporate self-regulation. That's not merely ironic, it's moronic. Meanwhile, BP itself says it wants to resume deep-water drilling in the Gulf, and highly publicized promises by the White House and Congress to tighten drilling rules are being stalled by industry lobbyists. Likewise, political pledges to stop the ecological blasphemy of mountaintop removal, confront the absurdity of natural gas fracking, deal with thousands of miles of leaking and exploding pipelines, respond to the dead zones in our oceans, do something about climate change, and address so many other environmental needs have been put on Washington's back burner. This is Jim Hightower saying, on this Earth Day, the irony is killing us. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. Believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, this past weekend being Easter and all, I find it interesting how our radical friends on the extreme right have been pushing for their tax cuts for the billionaires, and basically pushing this tough love. This tough love, buddy. Sorry, poor people. Tough love. You know, gonna give you the push to get you out there and get into the workforce. Even though there aren't any jobs out there. But basically, you know, causing more desperation. You know, what Republicans are good at. I found an interesting quote at, the American Prospector. An article by Jamie Brule, who said, the gospel is incredibly short on issues we associate with modern value voting, abortion and homosexuality, mostly, she says, and incredibly long on the reverence for the poor and disdain for the wealthy. Of course, that hasn't made much of a difference into the United States, though through its history it has combined religious piety with stunning accumulation of wealth. And, you know, as I sat in church on Sunday and I listened to the whole sermon and listened to all of the conversation going on, I couldn't help but come back to the political world where we are seeing right-wing governors around this country going after the needy, going after the homeless, going after the hungry, going after programs that do what Christ would have done. And look, I'm no evangelical. I try never to preach on this program. But the reality is you can look in the good book, if you will, and find place after place that talks about reaching out and helping those behind you. You know, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, giving shelter to those who are homeless. You can find that throughout the book. And there are a couple of, you know, very, very scant areas where you find the fringe issues that the radical right loves to harp upon, the wedge issues that divide us. And what I find interesting, there was a piece, an AP piece from Cleveland that said, churches wrestle with God's stance on union rights. And they're saying around the country, you've seen religious folks who have come out and said, you know what? We stand with union people, much like the Catholic Church when I was a kid. When I was a kid, the Catholic Church was right there with the union leaders in fighting for social justice and economic justice so that families could put food on the table, families could keep a roof over their head. The work that they performed was well paid. The conditions that they worked under were safe. That's how you promote family. You know, if the Republicans truly bought into that whole family values crap that they keep trying to sell us, they'd be out there pushing for a family-sustaining wage for every worker, health insurance for every family, old age security for seniors. But what all we keep seeing is, how can we stick it to those working people? How can we take more from them? How can we make sure that their future is more insecure? And I looked at this report over from the UK. It says a quarter of British young people, now 16 and under, according to the UK officials, say they will reach 100 years of age. A quarter of people in Britain will reach 100 years old. But experts like Danny Doring, who is a geographer, he's basically saying, not going to happen. He says, on life expectancy, Britain currently ranks near the developed nation bottom, right next to the United States. He claims that people just don't lead shorter lives in Britain and the United States. They lead deeply unequal lives. And he said, it's no coincidence. Decades of research have documented that people live longer, healthier, in places like Sweden that have a narrow income and wealth gap. So the people who have some money in their pocket, the folks who can afford health insurance, the folks who can afford to go to the doctor and get preventative checkups, those folks tend to live longer. The people who can afford to eat nutritious meals and vegetables instead of macaroni and cheese, those people tend to live a little longer. And it comes down to wealth equity, which we don't seem to have all that much of. And it's interesting, you know, that they brought up Sweden, because I remember a couple of weeks ago we talked to Bill Street from the Machinist Union, who said that IKEA, a Swedish company, who pays somewhere in the neighborhood of a minimum wage to their workers of $19 an hour in Sweden. If there's a factory in Sweden, it pays at least 19 bucks an hour. But in Virginia, they want to pay 8 bucks an hour. Why? Because we are such an unequal society. And look, they know how to exploit it. They're a multinational. They understand it. And I like what Bill Street said on the program. He said, you know, most people look at the U.S. like the U.S. looks to Mexico. A place to exploit their workers. And what's frustrating, you go back to this whole exercise this past weekend, where you had all these conservatives who got all gussied up in their Sunday best, and they went out to proclaim their Christianity and how godly they are. And then they come home and they point their finger at those immigrants, and they point their finger at those poor people, and they point their finger at those minorities. You know, I was talking about school vouchers over the weekend with my mother-in-law. And we were talking about, and she said, well, you know, in our neighborhood, they took a poll, and we'd be willing to pay for extracurriculars, you know, because, you know, it's a little bit better off area. But, you know, those minorities, you know, they wouldn't participate anyway. And I had to remind her that there are actually more poor white people than there are minorities. What we have is not black, white, Hispanic, white, Hispanic, black. We don't have that kind of a separation. What we have is a wealth separation, the separation of people who have against the people who don't. And that's what the people like Corbett and Kasich and Walker, that's what they're exploiting. They're making these fissures between, oh, it's those union people against the non-union people. It's the blacks against the whites, or the whites against the Hispanics, because we want to promote our hate. At the end of it, it's a green thing. This is about people who have the wealth and people who do not. And it comes back to education. It comes back to health care. It comes back to everything that we do. I had someone tell me the other, and this angered me to no end, They said that they don't want public transportation because those people will move into this neighborhood. Those people will come here. Like somehow I'm supposed to know who those people are. So $6, $7, $8, $10 a gallon doesn't matter. It's as long as we can isolate ourselves. At some point, we had better figure out how to close this inequality gap, how to close this wage gap. We better figure out how to tax people so that we can pay for the things that we need. All I keep hearing coming out of the Republicans, and help me if I'm wrong here, is more tax cuts for the very wealthy. More tax cuts for big corporations. In fact, even lower than they are now. More of the same. More of the same failed conservative ideology that has gotten us into this mess. From top to bottom. And their argument is we have gone far enough. We haven't deregulated enough. We haven't zeroed out the tax code. We haven't gotten rid of all of the regulations. We haven't taken down the entire fence to let the horses run wild. There's still one that maybe we can catch. But this idea that we haven't gone far enough, take a look around. I think we've gone far enough. I think the crumbling bridges and the holes in the potholes in the roads and the fact that we're still talking about cutting valuable resources to education, to me, tells me we've gone far enough, especially when we've got a billionaire class like the Koch brothers who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars influencing our politics, our policies, lobbying for their special interest at the expense of the rest of us. The fact that you've got people who are trying out of this state who are lobbying to pass SB1, this voucher bill that is going to be the end of public education as we know it. Somehow, they say this is a good thing. What do you say? How do you see this? I got to be honest. I'm completely set back by the apathy. At some point, don't we have to rise up and say no more? They're talking about destroying Medicare. They're talking about raising the Social Security age. They're talking about more tax cuts for the wealthy. And who pays for all of this stuff? You and me, we do. We pay for this. The Koch brothers are going to be fine. If we raise their taxes 10, 15, 20, 50% more, they are going to be fine. And you know what? Their grandchildren are going to be fine. And their great-grandchildren and their great-great-grandchildren. And down the line, they are going to be fine. What about your children? What about their opportunity? You look in Ohio. They're giving $1.4 billion away to corporations. $250,000 to pave a parking lot. Explain to me how that's economic development. What it sounds like is it sounds like a political payback. It sounds like a handout. And until the federal government steps in and says, no more of this beggar thy neighbor economic development, it's got to stop. Because we're killing ourselves before we get to the global marketplace, and then we're getting slaughtered. But maybe that's what it's going to take. But our media, you know what our media focuses on? Our media focuses on, and you can file this under, you got to be freaking kidding me. Evidently, it was big news that Sasha got Malaya's hand-me-down. Somehow it was big news that on Easter Sunday, the younger Obama daughter wore the dress that the older Obama daughter had worn back in August of 2008 in Denver to the Democratic Party presidential nomination. And who, I got to be honest, who keeps track of that? I don't know. Then we find out that, First Lady, she wore the same dress on Easter that she wore to the G20 summit back in 2009. Oh, my goodness. But yet, we can't find someone to report on how bad our trade deficits are killing us. We can't find any reporting on how globalization is killing us. But we know what Sasha and Malaya were. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Paul Quinn, professor at Kutztown University, is going to be here talking about the rally tomorrow. We're right back.
Just make us be brave, make us stay nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, the governor, our good governor, Tom Corporate, he has taken to the road, I guess, to try and convince Republicans and people across the state to support his scorched earth budget. He's talking about going to Erie County, to Chester County, and, of course, into Pittsburgh to tout his budget. I got to be honest, I don't know how you can go into any audience and say, I'm going to slash $1 billion from K through 12 education. I'm going to cut 56% of the higher education budget. I'm going to destroy your children's future and do that with a straight face. I just don't know how you go about that, which is probably why I'm not a politician. But tomorrow there's a rally here at the Capitol by some college students coming in and folks at the NAACP. I've asked Paul Quinn, a professor at Kutztown University, who will be one of the speakers there tomorrow, to come talk to us about the event. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. Tell me, what's going on tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow we have a lot of people getting together, not just higher education, but K through 12. You got some union workers that aren't even educators that are coming and support us, and we're going to have a big rally and show this governor what it's like when you try to mess around with our house.
At the end of the day, this is not an issue for just college students or just K through 12 or anyone. This is about the future of our state. And if we don't have an educated workforce, how are you going to attract jobs?
I agree with you. And this is bigger than just education itself. I mean, it's attack on the middle class, right? Keep the people undereducated so that they can't defend their rights and organize and do what has to be done. And what do? You have a small bunch of people, these aristocrats are in charge, and the rest of us are just their slaves, right?
I think George Carlin said it best, that they want people who are just smart enough to push the buttons and run the machines, but dumb enough not to ask why.
Right. No, I agree, and that's what they're looking for. So it's great that we're going to have, you know, some union people there that are not educators as well. I mean, the NAACP getting involved is great. I mean, you have people that are recognizing that this is an issue just above, you know, it's beyond just the education system, you know. And what's nice is that people are finally seeing the big picture so that they're all uniting. It's not just going to be, you know, the Paschi schools. This whole group of education people and other union workers across the state are going to tell the governor that he's wrong and he doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, what I worry about, and it's good to see that there are different groups, that there the K through 12 people and the college educators there as well, because what I was afraid of, and I still fear, is that you're going to see the two pitted against each other, and then you're going to see education pitted against poverty programs, pitted against senior programs. I'm worried where this is going to take us down the road.
You know, I the same thought crosses my mind because, you know, playing devil's advocate, you can see how, right, they'll blame, well, you know, these people want to get paid all this extravagant money and, you know, they take advantage of, you know, your money and your tax dollars and they'll try to turn us against each other. But we have to be smarter, right? I mean, again, if you look at that budget that he has, right, he's making increases to things that didn't even spend the money they had last year. So, you know, you got to stick to the issues and not let them, you know, try to put us against each other.
And that's the key, I believe. So tomorrow, what time is the event?
The actual event, I believe, is at 11 o'clock. We are leaving Kutztown at 8 a.m. on a bus. We're going to have a couple buses full of people. And I know there's others across the state. I mean, you know, some of the other colleges I've been in touch with. There's Westchester's going to have some people. I believe that Millersville is going to have some people. You know, the union presidents for all 14 we're talking about getting together. So around 11 o'clock, there's going to be a schedule. And again, there'll be a lot of speakers and stuff like last time. But it's going to be bigger, right, because you're going to have not just the college educators. You're going to have, you know, the education people from K through 12. And, again, a lot of union people that aren't even educators will be there. So it should be a very good event to give the message.
Yeah, looking forward to it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Paul Quinn, professor at Kutztown University, talking about the rally tomorrow. And I encourage everybody to come out to the Capitol steps tomorrow at 11 o'clock to participate. You know, in looking at this, what I'm hoping, and I'm maybe you guys are working on this, maybe you're not, but at the end of this, I do believe what has to happen to push this the right way is when finals are over, when the kids are done with college, and they're going to go home to find no job, that they find a sleeping bag, they find you know, a book, and they find their way here to the Capitol and make this home for the summer.
Well, see, and that's the thing. What's going to happen is, I mean, you know, one of the legislators last time said this, the strategy is to wait us out, right?
Yep.
So hopefully, you know, finals will be done and faculty and students and everybody, you know, won't care. And that's a message that we've been hammering home on our campus, that just because, you know, classes are over, you can't give up the fight. I mean, it has to continue because this guy's got to get the message.
So what are you hearing from the students that you're talking to? I know a couple of the organizers, they're hopeful, they're enthusiastic, but what are you hearing?
Well, you know, first of all, they like the idea of not quitting. So what's going on is they're actually organizing. Do you know Governor Corker is going to speak at Albright's graduation?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Albright College should be ashamed of themselves, right? They're going to have him speak there. So I know there's a bunch of KU students that are going to, you know, start organizing, and it's spread across the state system how what they're going to do is they're going to protest. We're going to give him a nice greeting party when he shows up there to talk.
And that's a good thing. I mean, he's got to hear it everywhere he goes.
Oh, yeah, he's got to hear it everywhere. It just amazes me that this guy tries to defend what he's doing, right? And he defends it illogically, right? All he says is, well, we need to cut. Everyone needs to share. But yet there's places that are not sharing in this. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
I'm not against shared sacrifice. I'll be honest. I'm not against shared sacrifice. I just want to see other people share. I don't want to be the one sacrificing.
Exactly. I don't mind sharing.
But when you're talking about...
That's what has happened.
But when you're talking about allowing revenue to fall off the table by not closing the Delaware loophole, by not taxing the Marcellus shale drillers, to me, that sends the wrong message.
It amazes me that they won't touch that shale. It's just unbelievable to me. It's like it's some sacred cow and no one wants to. And the thing is, it's not going to hurt that industry. If that industry is what they say it is, it's going to boom, right? So let them share. But no, you take it out of the education and probably the poor people would be working there, right? Because they can't get a job, because they can't get a diploma, because the schools are shut down.
Well, I mean, here's the sad thing and the dirty little secret. We're already paying the tax.
Yes.
I mean, it's in their business plan. It's already there. Every other state in the country that does this has a drilling tax.
Yep. Nope. I just don't know where he's coming from. And, you know, it also disappoints me. If you really believe strongly, that this is the way to do it, sit down and give your explanation for people to hear. He doesn't say a thing. You can't get this guy in the press other than to give his little stump speech, which he's had memorized.
Yeah. What's amazing to me is while they're talking about cutting all this money to education, they're talking about setting up another entitlement program for the very wealthy, with this voucher scheme this scam they've come up with, that to me is going to be the end of public education. Because I got to tell you, Paul, I think your bigger battle, bigger than this budget, is down the road. When they try and go in and completely privatize public education from top to bottom.
And that's where they're going, right? And when they do that, what will happen is the wealthy will have their great schools, and the poor people that are, you know, middle class and lower, you'll be stuck. And that's very scary because, again, that goes back to controlling people and not having people be educated so they can't actually fix things to make them better.
I mean, because I got to be honest, I've been paying attention a little bit more to what the kids – What your students are going through. You know, when I went to school, you had a couple of loans, but I'm seeing numbers of kids coming out of college in the 20-some thousand dollar range in debt.
Easily. I mean, easily. And the thing is, I mean, the one guy, Nick, from Kutztown that talks, I mean, this poor guy, he's working at a gas station every Sunday, right? I know, even more than Sunday. I mean, he works during the week. I mean, he's trying to, you know, pay his bills and even just pay off the interest of his college loans, right? And, you know, he's got to eat and, you know, he's got an apartment. So, you know, he's trying to work, and yet, you know, they're just going to take the education system and send it down. And, you know, what's going to hurt, too, is not just what it'll do to the students, but even the education programs are going to change, right? So, you know, I mean, last year we lost a nursing program. Now, right now is the time when you need nurses, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, there's a shortage. But yet our university's forced to cut it because of the stuff going on with the budget. And if they're going to, you know, to me it's like what they're doing is they're privatizing the state system slowly, right?
Of course.
And it's just... And it's terrible because, look, if you're going to privatize it, then just do it. And then I can argue against it that way, and then we can go in that direction. Or if you're going to not privatize it, then fund it and give it what it deserves. This in-between slow cancerous death, it's horrible.
Well, but I don't believe the citizens of this state, and I don't believe the citizens of the country, would buy into a for-profit, totally privatized education system. It has to be gradual. It has to be something that you wake up one day and you realize that the biggest university in the country is a for-profit, online, private institution.
It's like the analogy in science, you have an analogy, right? If you take a frog and you put the frog in boiling water, right, the frog jumps out. But if you put the frog in the water and it's cold and you slowly turn up the heat, the frog doesn't jump out because it's too late by the time his body realizes it's boiling. That's what they're doing with education.
Yep, that's right where we're at. So 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, you will be here in Harrisburg with thousands of students rallying on the Capitol steps. I encourage everyone to come out and participate. Professor Quinn, I appreciate your time. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to seeing you.
All righty. Again, tomorrow, 11 o'clock, Capitol steps. I hope everybody comes out because this is, you know, these are the important moments. This is what it's going to take. It's going to take people marching up and down the steps, telling this governor, not that he'll listen, telling more of the senators, telling more of the people in the House, don't be his good little soldier. Don't be the one that walks down off the plank. Be the one who stands up and fights for the working class, and you will be rewarded by being reelected. Because I got to tell you, these billion-dollar cuts, these continue. I see a lot of people not having a job next time around. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers are rallying in San Francisco today to defend ILWU Local 10 against a lawsuit filed by the Pacifica Maritime Association.
An injury to one is an injury to all.
That ILWU slogan is at the heart of today's rally in San Francisco. ILWU Local 10 shut down the Port of Oakland for 24 hours April 4th in solidarity with Wisconsin workers. The ILWU hung a banner with that slogan in Wisconsin's state capitol during the historic labor protests there. The Pacific Maritime Association is suing ILWU Local 10 for its solidarity action. The San Francisco Labor Council's Tim Paulson.
This is an attack on Local 10 for supporting the workers in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest of the United States against the attacks on collective bargaining and workers' rights. And we're urging people to stop down with brothers and sisters in Local 10 and protest this lawsuit.
The San Francisco Labor Council unanimously passed a resolution supporting ILWU Local 10. The rally today will demand that the Pacific Maritime Association drop its lawsuit against the local.
Coverage of the ongoing protests in Wisconsin against Governor Scott Walker have mostly been focused in the state capital of Madison. However, that's not the only place where state legislators who voted for the union busting legislation are feeling the heat of taxpayers. Listening sessions throughout the state are having echoes of the raucous healthcare town halls in 2009. In the town of Lake Haley in northwestern Wisconsin on Tuesday night, Republican State Senator Terry Moulton and Republican State Representative Kathy Bernier took part in a tense listening session where they were mostly criticized for siding with the governor. One woman asked the legislators to come to the schools and meet the people that will be impacted by the cuts.
I would ask that you please come to our school and meet our students and meet our staff and truly know who you are impacting.
A number of participants said they had sent letters and made phone calls to those representatives, but received no response. The representatives responded that they received thousands of emails and it would be difficult to respond to every one. One woman who did receive a response from both of the legislators said she was unimpressed.
Over the past 2 months, I've protested, I've emailed, and I've telephoned both of you. The responses I received were very disappointing. I received an email from Representative Bernier and a letter from Senator Moulton. In each, I was talked at, I was talked down to, and I felt like it was nothing but a big circle.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Well, you know, that's how it used to be. I mean, you know, I guess Pittsburgh still is producing more steel, but with an awful lot less workers. You look at Toledo, Ohio, the home of glass capital of the world, where they recently built a monument to the history of glass in Toledo, and they built it with Chinese-made glass. You know, we've lost 6 million jobs, a third of our manufacturing base since 1998. You know, we've lost 57,000 companies that used to employ 500 or more people. I shouldn't say that. We didn't lose them. Losing them kind of makes you think that we don't know where they are. We know exactly where they are. They're in China. And to me, that is, on a number of levels, a bad thing. But it is Manufacturing Monday, and we need to talk about where manufacturing is. That's why I've asked Dr. Joel Yudkin, founder of High Road Strategies. He is a nationally known expert on industrial energy, economic development, and technology policy. His report, Manufacturing Insecurity, America's Manufacturing Crisis, and the Erosion of the U.S. Defense Industrial Base, is linked to our site at thericksmithshow.com. Dr. Yudkin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, you look at those numbers. We've lost all these jobs. We've lost all these factories. We didn't lose them. They're gone. They're not here anymore. This is not a good thing.
Right. That's right. And, are you asking a question or?
Yeah, it's not a good thing. And what should we do on a policy level?
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure you wanted me to, you relating to my report or not. Basically, on a policy level, you know, I support what the AFL-CIO Industrial Union Council supports, another organization called the Coalition for Prosperous America, which the AFL-CIO belongs to, along with a lot of other manufacturers, that we need basically a new national manufacturing strategy that both addresses all the trade issues, addresses the way that we're at a disadvantage against especially some of the emerging economies like China because of unfair trade practices, labor standards, and lax environmental laws and things like that, subsidies that they're providing their nation, their country, and as well as much of the developed industrial world, which have industrial policies where they're targeting their manufacturing base be able to be competitive in the 21st century.
But at the end of this, don't you think the real culprit, the real enemy of this nation is this bizarre kind of theology to the free market and this idea of free trade, that we can open up our borders and allow people to dump and do the things that have been happening the last several years?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm a firm, well, how do I put it? I'm definitely... I had the same concerns that we have a lot of people, especially policymakers in Washington, and I live right outside of Washington, and I mostly work in Washington, have this belief that basically you call it a theology in free markets and free trade, and they dress it up in a lot of objective economics, but the fact is it really is a theology that is meant to, and an ideology to support a number of other interests, and that in the end undermines our own domestic capacity to produce and create jobs here.
You know, George Carlin used to say, we're this war society, we love blowing things up, and, you know, it's the only thing we seem to be able to make, because, you know, we better be able to make it because it's the only thing we seem to want to do. And I guess if we're going to be the world's policemen, at the very least, wouldn't you think that we should be able to make our own bombs and guns and even the nuts and bolts that you need for those as well?
Well, that's the central theme of what the study on manufacturing security was about. The main thesis is that, as you see the competitiveness and the health of our manufacturing base erode, and we've been seeing that erode, especially over the last decade, but this is actually, some trends that have been going on for quite some time. But they were accelerated in the last decade. As we see our domestic industrial base erode, it is also going to take with it our capacity to produce those specialized defense items that we also need for our national security. And that's because the defense industrial base really is part of the same fabric as our overall industrial base.
Right.
And as we unravel one, you start to unravel the other. As we see loss of jobs, we're seeing a decline or a weakening of our creation, of value-added creation, of our industrial capacity, and loss of industrial plants and so on, as you mentioned in the beginning. We see all these trends. We start realizing that capacity is eroding and unraveling. But the other thing is to see that there's a whole bunch of industries, from semiconductors to printed circuit boards to machine tools and even aerospace, in which, again, if you look at each one, and my study does that systematically, we also see dramatic erosion and moving offshore and a loss of domestic capacity. And all these industries I look at are also producing products that are important for national security. But the most important part of this, as I've come to realize, is that as manufacturing leaves our shore, we see our technological innovation capacity also leave. R&D starts to follow manufacturing, and we track all that as well across the board. And that, I think, in the end means that we basically lose the fundamental driver of our ability to be competitive, both domestically but also in hopefully we never come to this, but also in our ability to be competitive, maybe militarily.
And the thing that bothers me is, you know, you go back and you look at World War II, the whole reason that we were able to defeat fascism and the Nazis was because we were able to produce. We could turn car manufacturing facilities into tank plants and airplane plants. We had people who understood machining and being able to be tool and die makers and could make whatever you needed. I'm afraid by losing our manufacturing, and I think this is what your piece goes to, by losing those people who do those jobs, losing that knowledge base, having this brain drain, we're going to lose the ability to retool when we need to.
Well, I mean, actually, you know, for better or worse, it was World War II that really helped build up our manufacturing capacity to a whole new level. It brought into, you know, our aerospace industry basically grew out of World War II. It also created a very robust and powerful military-industrial complex, but also not only in manufacturing, but it also a research and development complex tying together the government and our industries, but also our academic community, and made us the most, the best research and development, I mean, the leader in research and development and technology innovation for several decades.
So how do we turn this around?
that
doesn't sound hopeful.
I mean, I'm always hopeful, but there's no you know magic bullet here. I think that you know I usually tie it to trade, you know, that various kinds of level of the playing field policies, which are you know based on our really addressing trade and currency policies and so on. And tax policies, which create incentives. All these things we should be tackling. These are the, as I say, these are level the playing field policies. These are, these are the necessary conditions for making any changes. And, you know, I would like to see the Obama, administration take this on much more directly and much more strongly and effectively than they've been doing. The other thing that we need to do is investment, and that's a tough thing to call on right now. I mean, we could be investing, and there's infrastructure and energy and so on. I mean, we've talked about this really for decades, but the need's not gone away. If anything, we need to reinvest in our infrastructure more than we've ever had before, because that's rapidly crumbling more than it was a decade ago, and they're complaining, they were worried about it then. The same thing. Now we have needs in not only spawning a whole new, renewable energy industries, but also greening and making our basic industries much more competitive by becoming much more energy efficient. It means next generation technologies, innovation, and so on. And so there needs to be an investment in technology and in infrastructure, energy, and a lot of other important national needs that actually create new demand for our manufacturing base. But we have to tie in provisions, and when we provide government support for these kinds of things, we need to build in stronger Buy America provisions.
I absolutely agree.
And that ties in to that. And, of course, you know, we shouldn't leave out the importance to really invest in workforce training and education and upgrading the skills at every level and tying it to this investment. One thing, you know, I always found the workforce investment side kind of an orphan to a lot of this stuff. You think, well, if we just, you know, educate people more and invest in workforce, you know, that's going to be enough to make us more competitive. You know, that's always to me seemed wrong. I mean, that we need to tie our investment in the workforce in to the investment we have in manufacturing capacity and in dealing with these national goals.
Because the reality, and I've said this a number of times on the program, if we don't build anything, if we don't produce things, we're not going to be a wealthy nation very much longer.
I think that is the danger that's happening right now. And it's our economic security and it's our national, you know, our defense security, our national security as a whole. Or you can say that national security is more than just defense. It ties into our economic security. And if we don't turn this corner, and we continue to see our manufacturing capacity erode, we're going to see the unraveling of our overall capacity. And I think that will feed into a lot of the inequalities you see today. You have a global class emerging who are not tied to the needs of our domestic economy, much less our domestic manufacturing base.
Now, I think we're already seeing, the handful of the global multinational corporations who they have no allegiance to this country or any country for that matter. It's all about the bottom line.
I mean, part of the thing we see, we've formed alliances with domestic manufacturers here who see the handwriting on the wall. I mean, a lot of them are part of the supplier chain for the bigger OEMs who are multinational. Many of them are struggling to keep a capacity here rather than finding themselves forced to go overseas in order to be suppliers to where these guys are going. So there are efforts, and they differ from a lot of their colleagues in organizations like the National Association of Manufacturing, which very much has the free market, free trade ideology. I mean, the leadership of that organization, that's their theology.
Right.
They're firm believers and promoters of that. But, I want to come back to one thing that I talked about, all these different elements of, how do we deal with the problem. What we need to do is that this needs to be a national strategy. We can't be thinking of these piecemeal. We need to make this a major national goal, and this has to be elevated to the level of saying we have to do this if we want to be successful in anything else we want to do in our society.
I agree, but you saw the outcry that happened when they tried to put the Buy American provision in the last time, and there was a political party who was so dead set against it that they would have held up everything that Obama wanted to do just to get that out of there.
Well, the way I look at it, I divide the world these days with not Republican, Democrat, but reasonable people and unreasonable people. And I know there's a lot of unreasonable folks in government right now, especially in Congress, who you can't really talk to, but I still think there's a lot of reasonable, even Republicans we should be talking to, because their districts are getting hammered, especially in the heartland, just like everybody else. And so, in some of this stuff here on trade issues and they may have some trouble around investment, but even some of the members, these other organizations I were involved in that include manufacturers, many of them are quite conservative folks, right?
Right.
But, and they even kind of border on Tea Party. But when you start talking about we need national investment, we need to deal with this, and we need national strategy, I'm often surprised that we really do need that. And I mean, we've even gone lobbying with some of these guys. So I think we need to kind of cut this a different way. It isn't just it isn't just Democrats versus Republicans. It's about, we need to kind of frame that this is really a national need, a national goal, and that there are folks in, many of folks in places like Ohio and, Pennsylvania, where you are, right, and most of the heartland, Michigan, and so on. A lot of the union members, a lot of their cohort, the union members do better in voting Democrat than, non-union members of the same, the same cohort, right? But a lot of working class folks voted Republican. They're fearful and they're scared and they don't see any way out of the mess they're in. They don't see the jobs and so on. And I think that there is a message we could be crafting to cut through this stuff that is built around manufacturing. And so, when you get to things like specific aspects like Buy America, if you have this logical political context that you're building and base around, we gotta re-bring back manufacturing. It's important for our domestic economy, but it's also important for national security, which is one of the reasons we wanted to emphasize that. That cuts across boundaries too. That people are recognized. We can't keep on seeing our manufacturing base slide because we'll also lose our ability to be, for national security and deal not only with the international threats in the Middle East, but also the concern about China, and we need to remain strong here in order to kind of balance off the growing strength of China, which has a lot of aspirations. I don't think they want a war, but I think they have a lot of global aspirations.
Sure, and what they want is they want our manufacturing base, which to me, again, I think we've handed over without much of a fight. Anyway, the piece is Manufacturing Insecurity, America's Manufacturing Crisis, and the Erosion of the U.S. Defense Industrial Base. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. It's worth checking out. A very well thought out piece. Dr. Yudkin, I appreciate your time. Great work there.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, too.
Alrighty, we're going to take a quick break. Rick Bat with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
In case you missed it, America just celebrated its National Day of Irony, April 22nd. The irony is that this date is not only Earth Day, but also happens to be the day that BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig sank into the Gulf of Mexico 1 year ago. If a novelist or movie scriptwriter juxtaposed the date of a hellish environmental catastrophe with that of a day when thousands of Americans gathered to celebrate and promote environmental protection, the plot would be hooted down as a cheap attempt to manufacture drama. Reality, however, has a way of creating its own ironies, and the BP Earth Day convergence was not the only one of April 22nd. Just 1 week prior, the corporate-hugging House of Representatives chose to demonstrate its commitment to Earth's fragile ecology by passing the GOP's extremist budget plan. Included were provisions to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate corporations that emit the greenhouse gases causing today's disastrous climate changes. But that wasn't extreme enough. The plan also slashed EPA's budget, leaving our Earth and ourselves to the tender mercies of corporate self-regulation. That's not merely ironic, it's moronic. Meanwhile, BP itself says it wants to resume deep water drilling in the Gulf, and highly publicized promises by the White House and Congress to tighten drilling rules are being stalled by industry lobbyists. Likewise, political pledges to stop the ecological blasphemy of mountaintop removal, confront the absurdity of natural gas fracking, deal with thousands of miles of leaking and exploding pipelines, respond to the dead zones in our oceans, do something about climate change, and address so many other environmental needs have been put on Washington's back burner. This is Jim Hightower saying, on this Earth Day, the irony is killing us.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, I guess the key there being crazy. The Borowitz report today on Donald Trump, a threat to the fledgling presidential campaign of Donald Trump, Andy Borowitz writes, emerged today as a group of activists charged that Mr. Trump is not eligible to hold the nation's highest office because his hair does not originate from the U.S. The group, who call themselves the Balders, claim that the hair-like substance that crowns Mr. Trump's head is from a foreign country, which would mean that the candidate is less than 100% pure American. Leanne Swilleen, a leading Balder, said, time and time again, Donald Trump has refused to produce a certificate of authenticity for his hair. This is tantamount to a comb-over of truth. But if, in fact, Mr. Trump's distinctive mane turns out to be of a foreign origin, such a revelation need not be fatal to his presidential hopes, says Professor David Lodkin, who has studied the history of presidential hair at the University of Minnesota. He says, remember several of our greatest early presidents like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had hair that originated elsewhere. The only thing that could kill Trump politically, if his hair turns out to be from France, at a GOP event in Iowa, Mr. Trump made no reference to the Baldur's controversy and instead sounded an upbeat theme, saying, quote, "If I'm given the chance to do the same magic I did for NBC, America will be the number four country in the world." And a piece of good news for Mr. Trump, a poll now shows a majority of likely voters agreeing with the statement Donald Trump being sworn in as president would be a great last scene in the Planet of the Apes remake. Interesting stuff. I'm not going to be honest, not a huge Donald Trump fan, but it will be an interesting couple of months as we move through to election time. Let's go to the phones. I got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, all right. You guys all right?
Hey, you know, hanging in there.
You know, the idea of the free trade, you know, there's a problem that you've got an additional problem there to the point that, you know, that once it was agreed to, that became law. But also, you know, it was put into the framework of the WTO and opens us to adjudication by that world body.
Yep. So, unless you back out of it, you know, unless you tell Canada and Mexico, sorry, not going to happen, but that's never going to happen.
Well, one of the big things on the line with that trade agreement right now is the Mexican trucking situation.
Oh, how I know.
And God forbid you let them come across this border, I'm telling you now. You're going to see increase in drugs and smuggling like you ain't ever seen before. Not to mention what it's going to do to the working men and women in the trucking business.
Yeah, who are already struggling to make ends meet. And, you know, I got to be honest, for years I held no sympathy for the owner-operators or the independents, had no sympathy for them because they put themselves into that mess by not organizing. But you got to be honest, they're going to get slaughtered when they open that border.
No doubt, you know, and years ago, I was involved in trucking when the Teamsters went out on strike and all the other people, when the Wildcatters kept running. And I told them then, and I said, you know what, if you don't back up the Teamsters, you guys are going to rue the day. And sure enough, they didn't do it. I got out of trucking just after that because I knew what was going to happen. And it came to pass. But let me run something by them as a statement. We all can agree that demand is what expands business.
Yep.
Either for the product or the service. Now, if you're, you know, you always keep hearing from the Republicans that this deal about, well, the markets are uncertain. That's why they're not loaning. That's why they're not, you know, it's not going the way that it should because of the uncertainty in the market. Well, let's make you a loan, you know, a person that loans money. You know, you can be a bank or whatever. You loan for mortgages, cars, household appliances, whatever, okay? What sense does it make in the economy where we're at if the Republicans are so concerned about uncertainty in the market that you would literally go after one of the most stable workforces in the whole entire economy, such as the union public employees? I mean, those people were the ones that could sign on the dotted line, and the loan, the people that handed out those loans felt relatively confident that these folks would be able to pay their way because they had a good job and they had jobability. Well, if you go crush them, then you've just taken another segment out of the market that you can't be sure of and that you can't loan to.
Yeah, but politically you cannot allow them to exist because they're your enemy. I've said it a million times. This is a very Machiavellian move. This is taking your enemy into the square and gutting them in public for anyone who dare oppose you to see. This is what this is all about. It has nothing to do with budgets. Has nothing to do with, you know, balancing the budget or trying to make things fair. This has everything to do with political payback.
Sure, and if you want to grow the economy, I've said it before, just because you're in over your, you know, just because you've taken out a mortgage on your house doesn't mean that you don't pay the lights, the water, buy food, buy gas, and all these other things. You don't take every penny and put it towards your mortgage till you've got your mortgage paid off. That's not how you go about it. And the other thing you don't do, you damn sure don't cut your income. You do everything that you can to increase your income. So if you take that analogy and you apply it to the budget, then any fool knows. You don't just cut. You've got to increase your income. And for the life of me, if I hear one more time this shared sacrifice crap, what the hell do they think it is that we just went through with Wall Street? How much shared sacrifice, you know, did we wind up with on Main Street for the sake of Wall Street?
Yeah, again, there's never been any shared sacrifice. It's been you and I suffering and them walking away with more of our money.
Well, I still say, you know, listen, I got an answer for the commodities problem. You increase the amount of money that they have to put down to get into the trade. That's to start with. And you also have to put a provision in there that they have to be able to take delivery. In other words, license them as broker dealers, and they have to be able to take whatever it is they bid on. If they can't do that, then they don't need to be bidding.
Yep.
But also too, I think that you should put a 0.1 penny tax on every transaction that goes through Wall Street.
Yeah,
and that should go.
I'm more of a quarter to a half, but 0.1 is it's something. I'm more of a quarter to a half guy.
On an average of how many millions of trades just in the Dow?
Yep, that are just computerized.
Every day. I mean, that would add up, and I don't see where they could complain. You know, as far as the percentage goes, you know, I just see the revenue side as being important and to be addressed before they even talk about coming after anybody when it comes down to the safety net programs. I mean, I'm sorry. And by the way, the next time you run into a conservative that wants to make this Ayn Randian type argument, just remind him something. You know, yeah, it may be true, you know, that the rich folks could shut down and it would put a hurt on people. But at the same time, the working folk, you know, when it comes right down to it, the rich can't eat their money and the working folk sure can't eat dirt. So we've got to come to a middle ground here and we've got to make it work for everybody.
Excellent point, Ike. Excellent point. Thanks so much. I appreciate
Thanks,
the call,
brother.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of it, that's what it comes down to. Today, anyway, there was the great budget bake sale at the Capitol. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Serena Fedor, who was one of the speakers and one of the mothers that came out to voice her concern about the Governor Corporate's big budget cuts. We'll take a break. We're right back.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high-interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You know, back before the November elections, it sounded so good. We're going to cut spending. We're going to cut spending. We're going to balance the budget. And all along, I kept asking my tea twizzler friends on whose back. Who is going to be the one paying for it? And they all said, those people. Turns out those people are our children. You look at the budget put out today, put out by Governor Corporate, and basically that's what's happening. So today was the great bake sale, the great cookie day at the Capitol, and a number of concerned citizens took to the rotunda to demonstrate just how many cookies it would take to fill the void left by Governor Corporate's scorched earth budget. I've got Serena Fedora on the line. She was one of those concerned citizens who participated and spoke out at the rally. Serena, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You came out. Tell me, what did you see? What happened? Tell me about the great cookie sale.
Yeah. So today at the rotunda, there were tables of cookies set up there and listed how many you would have to sell in order to make up the difference by district. And really, when it came down to it, Rick, there really aren't enough car washes, bake sales, or yard sales that we could do to possibly make up the difference from the governor's cuts. Governor Corbett, you know, I'm assuming he supports property tax increases, and I think that's wrong. Property taxes are really inequitable, and instead of forcing our schools to raise property tax, the governor really should have the courage to tax tobacco, Marcellus Shale, close the Delaware loophole where 70% of corporations in PA get away with paying no state taxes. You know, I have to give a big thank you to Susan Zicka, Erica Berg, and Katie Clay for organizing this event. You know, I went today because I'm a mother of two young children, and I'm really concerned about their future, the future of public education here under Governor Corbett. And, you know, with everything that he's proposed, giveaway after giveaway to wealthy corporations and only cut after cut for our children. I was really surprised today to learn, too, that every district in Pennsylvania is going to have its education budget cut, most by millions of dollars. And I don't believe mom dads really know how much is going to be cut. And the sad part is that many of them won't realize this until the fall when teachers start disappearing, activities disappear from classrooms, the people that they counted on aren't there. And that really scares me, and it angers me, and I think it will a lot of moms and dads as well.
You know, in fact, I think you make an interesting point there, but I think the school administrators and the school boards, they don't even know how bad the cuts are going to be. They don't even know at the end of this what kind of budget they're going to have in the fall either. You know, because I went and I talked to the superintendent of my children's school district because there was rumor that they'd be cutting the full-day kindergarten program, which I think is vital to our district. And he's saying, look, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. Could be good, could be bad, but at the end of it, we got to plan for the worst. And to me, that's dangerous.
Absolutely. And I learned today, I mean, Jackson and Parker School, we live in the Cumberland Valley School District, they would see a $1.4 million cut under the governor's proposed budget. That's just wrong. I mean, how can we afford to cut education at a time that it's more critical than ever? How are we expecting that our children are going to be able to compete in a global marketplace? It's crazy.
It is crazy. So let me ask you, for your district, how many cookies would you have to, you know, if you wanted to take this on as a task and you got, you know, your mittens and your oven going, how many cookies would you guys have to bake there?
4 million cookies. 4 million.
Oh, come on. You can knock that out in a weekend.
Oh, sure.
But what it shows is 4 million cookies. You know, where would you find the people to buy it? And all of this, to me, again, it comes to this short-sighted view that folks have of what this governor is going to do. And sadly, it's this pushing the can down the road. It's this pushing the problem down on someone else. That's what bothers me. And as I understand your husband, Mike, running for Cumberland County Commissioner, this can't help him either.
No, absolutely not at all. I mean, you know, the real reason that Michael is running for county commissioner is he's fighting for families like ours. He's fighting to make sure that, you know, he can be a champion for families, working families here in the county, to help us through these difficult times and really be that leader that we can count on.
See, I got to give you credit for one reason. My wife has told me I can never run for any political office ever. Because one, she doesn't want to be in the fishbowl. Two, she doesn't want to have to speak to anybody. And three, she doesn't want my past dug up, because she doesn't want to know anything like that about me. So I got to give you credit for that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I will tell you that, you know, Michael, he's putting in long hours. We are making sacrifices, but it's really nothing in comparison to when you're out there talking to the people in this county and you're hearing about the sacrifices that they're having to make. You know, they're worried about being able to put gas in their car to pay their mortgage. You know, that's why Michael's out there fighting. That's why we're making those the sacrifices that we're making, because we need a strong leader like him in this county, someone that's going to fight for us.
Before I ask you some more cookie questions, can we throw a quick plug in for his website and if you wanted to volunteer kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. You can go to his website. It's votefedor.com. There you can request a yard sign. You can sign up to volunteer. You can make a donation. We only have 21 more days to go, so we need all the support that we can get.
Good stuff. Go back to the cookie sale today. How many people did you have out? What kind of response did you think you got? And are there things planned for the future?
Yeah, there was, I think we had a great response. There were probably 30 plus people out today. There were, you know, a lot of mothers there, a lot of children there in support. So I would say that we had a good showing. It's not going to stop there. We're going to continue to go out into our communities and educate folks. I think that's the big thing that, you know, moms and dads that are out there, they're not going to realize that these cuts are even planned. I didn't even realize the extent of it until I was there today. So it's really important that we get the message out and we continue to fight against it.
And some of the folks that you met there today, was there a political bent one way or another, or do you think this is a bipartisan thing that across the board, I don't care where you stand on the political spectrum, these cuts are just plain wrong. But I'm curious what your experience was.
No, absolutely. You're right, Rick. It was bipartisan. You know, really at the end of the day, it's about our children. It's about our future. And, you know, education is not a privilege. It's a right here in Pennsylvania, and we need to fight to make sure that, you know, our children are getting the best that they can get.
Last question I've got for you. What kind of cookies did you bring today?
I actually did not bring cookies today, I have to be honest. So.
That's it. Well, politician's wife, very honest. Good for you. Good for you. Serena, I appreciate the time. Thanks for your time, and thanks for the work you're doing.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, and I look at this cookie thing, and you look at the millions that would have to be sold just to fill a portion of this budget, and it's... I got to be honest, it's just plain wrong, and it's stupid. You know, at the end of the day, I think that folks have got to wake up and realize that that it sounded good. It did. You know, it sounded great. We're gonna balance the budget. We're gonna cut spending. We're gonna do all these things. But we never bothered to ask, where are the cuts? Where's this? Show me the office of waste, fraud, and abuse. Show me that gold-plated door with the hole in it, with the burning pit where we throw our tax money. Show it to me. Problem is, it doesn't exist. That's the problem. And for too long, we've been demanding things that politicians told us we didn't have to pay for. And they kept giving handouts to the very wealthy. That's where we are. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever
ever met someone who can literally fix anything, that's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make people in the habit.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Another one has fallen already, and we haven't even really gotten into the thick of things yet with the 2012 presidential race. Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour has said, you know, I don't have the fire in my belly. I don't have the fire in my gut. You know, it's got to be ready for that all-consuming effort. Got to be ready. Got to have it. Turns out he doesn't. He is known as a very prolific fundraiser. That I think he likes, you know, the rubber chicken dinner and the funny ha-ha speeches. But that whole run for the White House, it is a lot of work. And I got to be honest, I don't know that I wouldn't want to do it. I don't want every word I've ever uttered. I don't want to live in that fishbowl. And I don't know many people who do. You know, all the problems, all of the turmoil, all of the hatred, the visceral, this hatred, this vitriol that, I don't know that I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't put my family through it. So I don't have any problem with Haley Barbour stepping aside. Now for him, it's over. And I guess he's going to be out of a job soon since he's being term limited out as Mississippi governor. But tomorrow, keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, because Ron Paul is supposed to be making an important announcement. So tomorrow, somewhere in Iowa, he's going to be making an important announcement. Maybe they found Rand a toilet that flushes. Maybe, just maybe. Maybe he got one of those $6,400 Kohler deals, you know, with the oscillating and pulsating bidet. Oscillating and pulsating. Imagine that. And, you know, Donald Trump, again, as I said, you know, earlier in the Borowitz report, you know, the balders are heading out on him. But a bigger question about Trump was brought up by Elliot Spitzer, and they claim he's the first one to ask about Trump's wealth. Maybe not the first. I did question the two bankruptcies he had and the idea of him being able to self-fund his $600 million campaign. I did ask about that. But, you know, but Elliot's the guy who got it out there. Trump says he's worth somewhere around $3.5 billion. But according to Northfolk Bank, during one of their loan investigations, they put his wealth somewhere around 1.2, and Deutsche Bank puts it around $750 million. So maybe he can self-fund a losing campaign and just file bankruptcy again. Maybe that's the thing. And I go back to that bankruptcy because I think those two bankruptcies, because he didn't only do it once, he did it twice. as I've seen reported. And I go back to that because I think it's important to understand. This is a guy who believes in the privilege of the wealthy. The idea that, you know what, the bankruptcy laws are there for your use. Which, I, you know, I think about as I look at our financial situation in this country. If I were one of the folks who were completely upside down on my mortgage, I might be tempted to just say, you know what, walk away from it. Because it's never coming back. Which is why, again, right from the beginning, the policymakers in this country made a horrible, horrible choice. Horrible choice. Anyway, you might want to keep your eyes out at the bookstores. The heavily edited words of Levi Johnston are coming to a bookshelf near you. Levi Johnston, Sarah Palin's daughter's baby daddy. He's writing a tell-all book. Oh, boy! As if the Vanity Fair article back in 2009 that he recanted wasn't enough. You can get, you know, a couple hundred pages of Levi, all Levi, all the time. It's going to be published by Touchstone Publishing, one of the Simon and Schuster people. And it's been called a sweet story. And funny. Sweet and funny with a touch of irony. Not quite sure exactly how that's going to turn out. But, hey, if you're into that, good for you. While we're in Alaska, evidently the last Saturday in July will be known from now until the eternity as Ted Stevens Day, according to a new law that has memorialized the nation's longest-serving Republican senator who died last year in a plane crash. The bill was signed last Friday by Governor Sean Parnell. At a ceremony in Juneau. He served 40 years in the Senate, lost to a Democrat, Anchorage Mayor Mark Began. So, interesting, mark your calendars for that as well. The last Saturday in July will be Ted Stevens Day in Alaska. Senator Chris Coons, the person who beat the witch, or the one who's not the witch. He was on Face the Nation on Sunday. He was talking about his frustration over the Senate's vacation schedule. And, you know, I got to be honest, you know, how often have they been on vacation? I think it's 5 since January. 5. How do I get a gig like that? But, you know, Coons, a freshman, he said, look, you know, at the end of this, I don't think that the Senate is making much progress. It's not making as much as it needs to. He says, at times I'm so frustrated I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall trying to encourage forward movement. And, you know, the reality is I've advocated for locking those guys in a room and saying, not until you leave. You're not leaving until you figure something out, which, again, it would give them less time to come out and do the ridiculous stuff that they do, like John Boehner coming out today and saying, well, you know, I think the president's going to have a very difficult time getting reelected because of gas prices. You know, he was interviewed by ABC News and, you know, basically said, you know, he's going to lose his reelection campaign because of the gas prices. He said, quote, if the economy doesn't get better, I don't think he'll win. If people don't feel better about government-run health care, I don't think he'll win. If gas prices are $5 or $6 a gallon, he certainly isn't going to win. Which is why we're going to see $6 a gallon gasoline. Understand that. This is already in the cards. The people who run this country, they've already figured that out. They want to make it as painful for you as possible. Now, it all depends on how this thing plays out politically. Obama has appointed a task force to look into it. Attorney General Eric Holder is supposed to be going after fraud and manipulation in the gas prices. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, OPEC, they pulled down their production a little bit. You got a little bit of speculation over here. China's ramping up. Prices are going to go up. And what they've done, what the Republicans have done a masterful job of doing, is stall and delay. You look at that whole recovery bill. A lot of it was supposed to have big money in it for looking for alternative energy. we haven't done enough. We haven't done as much as we should be doing. We should be putting solar panels everywhere. We should be putting up windmills made in the U.S. And, you know, going back to our discussion earlier of manufacturing policy, the reality is what we should have been doing is not saying here are massive tax breaks. What we should have been saying is we need to buy 10 million solar panels. Who's going to produce them and how much are they going to produce them for? And we need people who are going to install them. How much is it going to cost to install each one? And give people work by creating demand. That's what should have happened. And over the weekend, the president had his weekly radio address where he said he wanted to end the $4 billion in handouts to the oil and gas companies. And he wants to, we need more domestic production. We need to invest in clean and renewable energy. Yeah. Heard that a bunch. But look, the Republicans, Boehner and the other ones, they're the oil industry lackeys, just like Tom Corbett over here is the Marcellus Shales people's little miss thing. Ain't happening. And until we, you, me, stand up and say, you know what? We need to do something about this. We need you to do something. And we vote for people who are going to do something. It's never going to change. We're easily divided by nonsense. You know, the abortion issue, and I go back to this because of the weekend. The abortion issue, the gay marriage thing, nonsense. The fact that we've got kids that are hungry in this country. We've got families that are homeless in this community. That's a shame. That's a national disgrace for the richest country in the world. And we've got people who would deny them a bit of assistance. That's what bothers me. And it bothers me when we see a budget like this one that cuts $1 billion from education, 56% from higher education. That bothers me. It tells me our priorities are skewed. And we've got a screwed up value system. When the family values people are the ones who are telling the children, sorry, your future, not that important to us. What's important is $1.4 billion in Ohio to hand out to companies to, you know, to pave their driveway or, you know, to, you know, maybe add a little kitchenette or something. There's a whole list of things that they had spent money on that, you know, really? This encourages economic development? Not really. So when we talk about tax dollars and how that money is spent, I don't think our friends on the radical right have all that much to celebrate, especially when you look at what's going on in Ohio and you look at what's going on here, where we're talking about handing out $1 billion over 10 years to private education, to the people, the campaign donors. The folks who aren't from this state, who are spending millions of dollars to push this through. Why the hurry? That's what bothers me. Why the hurry? Anyway, I don't know how people can put up with this. I really don't. I don't know how folks can really take this sitting down. I'm just not getting it. I'm outraged at the fact that this guy who's supposed to be the family values guy is pulling this crap. And you should be outraged too. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast. If you got any questions, comments, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Workers are rallying in San Francisco today to defend ILWU Local 10 against a lawsuit filed by the Pacifica Maritime Association.
An injury to one is an injury to all. That ILWU slogan is at the heart of today's rally in San Francisco. ILWU Local 10 shut down the Port of Oakland for 24 hours April 4th in solidarity with Wisconsin workers. The ILWU hung a banner with that slogan in Wisconsin's state capitol during the historic labor protests there. The Pacific Maritime Association is suing ILWU Local 10 for its solidarity action. The San Francisco Labor Council's Tim Paulson.
This is an attack on Local 10 for supporting the workers in Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest of the United States against the attacks on collective bargaining and workers' rights. And we're urging people to stop down with brothers and sisters in Local 10 and protest this lawsuit.
The San Francisco Labor Council unanimously passed a resolution supporting ILWU Local 10. The rally today will demand that the Pacific Maritime Association drop its lawsuit against the local.
Coverage of the ongoing protests in Wisconsin against Governor Scott Walker have mostly been focused in the state capital of Madison. However, that's not the only place where state legislators who voted for the union-busting legislation are feeling the heat of taxpayers. Listening sessions throughout the state are having echoes of the raucous healthcare town halls in 2009. In the town of Lake Haley in northwestern Wisconsin on Tuesday night, Republican State Senator Terry Moulton and Republican State Representative Kathy Bernier took part in a tense listening session where they were mostly criticized for siding with the governor. One woman asked the legislators to come to the schools and meet the people that will be impacted by the cuts.
I would ask that you please come to our schools and meet our students and meet our staff and truly know who you are impacting.
A number of participants said they had sent letters and made phone calls to those representatives, but received no response. The representatives responded that they received thousands of emails, and it would be difficult to respond to every one. One woman who did receive a response from both of the legislators said she was unimpressed.
Over the past 2 months, I've protested, I've emailed, and I've telephoned both of you. The responses I received were very disappointing. I received an email from Representative Bernier and a letter from Senator Moulton. In each, I was talked at, I was talked down to, and I felt like it was nothing but a big circle.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Well, it's been a while since we thought that were the Employee Free Choice Act was possible. But again, it's something else I would love to see. But the reality is, for the last couple of days, all I've been hearing are the right wing losing their ever-loving freaking minds over this Boeing decision by the National Labor Relations Board. Personally, I think it's a great decision. It finally says workers have a right. I know it's amazing. Sit down. Don't fall. You actually do have rights in this country. It's just that we've for so long had people who don't enforce them. And I think this is a great decision, which is why I've asked Rich Michalski, General Vice President of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, to come talk to us about this Boeing decision. Rich, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're very welcome, I welcome the chance to be able to speak about it. This is a good decision that the NLRB made, and we look forward to the upcoming litigation.
So this isn't law yet. This is one general counsel's decision on an unfair labor practice, correct?
Yes. It goes before a judge, and there will be a hearing, and it will be a public hearing, so it will be all on the record. and Boeing can state their case, and the government will state theirs.
I've got my calendar marked for June 14th.
That's right.
There will be a hearing in Seattle before an administrative law judge. This is a huge deal, I think, because for the first time in really in my working life, the NLRB has come out and said you actually have a right to strike, and companies cannot take that away from you.
Well, I think the bigger this is all about individual rights and our right as individuals to be able to collectively bargain and protect our pensions, our wages, our futures for ourselves and our families. So in that respect, this covers and protects even the individuals in South Carolina who really need protection. But, this also is it stands up and identifies some real problems in this country where, elected officials in South Carolina can bog down the system because of their political power and slow things down to a point where, this should have been resolved many, many, many months ago.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but the governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, she actually came out and said she was going to work to make sure that the union didn't get in the Boeing plant in South Carolina. Am I correct there?
Well, she said that she will work against us and all unions to prevent them from getting a hold in their state. They want to suppress wages. They want to suppress, make sure that people do not absolutely have pensions or any kind of quality health care. I mean, that's what they're all about. They're open for that kind of business. And, there's a stark difference between us and them. The traditions of Washington State versus a place like that are incomparable. The history that we have in the Northwest of being progressive, providing for education, nurturing skills and technologies, Microsoft just didn't happen. I mean, this is a tradition in the Puget Sound that has spawned so many great businesses.
So help walk me through this case. What is it about, and walk me through the history and into the decision?
Well, first of all, I think, Rick, you really have to identify what has gone on within the aerospace industry and especially at the Boeing Company. The people running the company no longer are people who have a passion for building airplanes. They are bankers and others that are on that board. Bill Daley, the chief of staff for the president of the United States, a banker, was a board member who voted on this move to South Carolina. So what they did, they made a move. They made a statement, the leaders of the company, more than once in public, saying they were going to, and I'm not going to quote them, but for all purposes, punish the workers for taking action and striking for 42 days. Now, at the time, they said that was a big deal because it was going to delay the 787. That 787 is now 5 years delayed. 42 days does not equal 5 years.
Right.
But clearly, they wanted to punish us. We went to the NLRB and presented our case, all facts. And what really stands out is, the leadership of the company making these brazen statements. And, we came there armed with statements of our members, citizens of the communities where they live, who heard those same words and asked what their opinion was of those statements. And I think they weighed very heavily in the decision-making process. Now, at the same time, this could have been resolved or at least gone to a judge almost a year ago, but it didn't because of delaying tactics that the company and right-wing politicians employed. So a lot of this would have been behind us already.
Yeah, and what this shows to me, and I got to be honest, the more I look into this, the more I look at it, it shows to me how screwed up our laws in this country are and how you know, we talk about being a United States, and we talk about being united on numerous fronts and fighting in this global economy. What's interesting to me is that we beat each other up state to state. We do all of these things to destroy the working conditions of the average working class person, and basically bloody ourselves even before we get into the global arena.
Well, Rick, you know, you're so right, but let me just say something about the people that we represent and the people that we don't represent at the Boeing Company and the related industries in the Puget Sound and up down in Portland. You know, there is no one, not this union, not anyone who wants to harm the Boeing Company. We want to build quality planes and deliver them across the globe. That's what we want to do. We're very proud of what we do. We have generations of families that are there. We believe in this company. We don't want to be in this spot, but that's just the way it is.
And the reality is, I remember the IAM being one of the loudest voices out there when the tanker deal was going on.
Well, we've worked, I personally and many people on our staff have worked tirelessly to get that deal done. And everybody, from the top of the Boeing Company to the person on the line, you know, did whatever we could to make sure that that happened. Cutting costs, improving quality, making sure that in the long term we'll be able to deliver a good product for the Air Force. And you know, that is ingrained in the people in the Northwest. You just don't pick that up and move that somewhere and put it on an assembly line. You can refer to the building of airplanes on an assembly line. You can, but there's a lot more to it than that. And it's a culture.
And it's something, again, you know, it's about having, for me, you know, I know you talk about the planes and you talk about the people at Boeing, but on the bigger stage, it's about having a voice. It's about having some say. You know, I look around the globe and I see, you know, workers who sit on the boards of their companies, workers representatives who sit on the boards of the companies. And here, as you point out, it's all bankers. It's all about dollars and cents. It's all about profit. How much can we squeeze out of the workforce?
You know, there, you know, either you have a passion for something or you don't. The difference between winning and losing is who has more passion and who has more drive and desire to attain excellence. And, you know, go back, don't even think about this, but just go back to the moving of the headquarters to Chicago. I mean, what sense did that make?
No sense at all. I mean, in fact, it's a Delaware. The company's incorporated in Delaware so they can get away from paying taxes.
Right. And, you know, I mean, that's just, you know, this is not unlike a lot of other companies in this country.
But what do you say to the person? Let me ask you this, Rich. What do you say to the person who says, well, a company should be able to do whatever they want, go wherever they want, and the workers be damned? Which is what I'm hearing from the right wing. How can these union thugs, how can they possibly tell Boeing, this great grand company, that they can't do something that's in their best interests?
Rick, first of all, we didn't push our weight around. We were very careful about what we said and what we did. We made it very clear, like I made clear to you tonight, you know, we're not out to put a stake in the heart of the Boeing Company.
No, that makes no sense.
There's something said here about when people come, and it's a very key point, and you live your life this way, and I think we all do, but when you go to the state of Washington and say, I want to build a 787, and I want to build a 787 in Washington, but I'm thinking about doing something else, and Washington comes up with $3.2 billion.
Ooh.
And $3.2 billion from the state. Now, that's your money. That's your tax dollar. And all of a sudden, a year and a half later, they say, well, now we want to build a second line. Now, would you have given that $3.2 billion being an elected official to somebody by saying, I'm going to build the first 787 line, and I may build a second somewhere else? Now, how stupid is that? How disingenuous is that?
Yeah, I'm now, you don't hear that on the right-wing shows.
Well, they should be telling that. I mean, you know, you want to talk about something? And now the state of Carolina, South Carolina, spent $1.2 billion to build that plant down there, whatever they did. I'm sure that the money just didn't come from Charleston, but it came from the poorest areas in that state where schools aren't going to be funded and kids aren't going to be taken care of. That's just a matter of fact. But the idea here was the company said, we're going to punish you people in the state of Washington. We're going to show everybody that we can do it. And that's what the NLRB reacted to.
Yeah, and again, that's why I say it's the right decision, because it does say, look, you have a right, and you can't be. I mean, they were really blatant about this. I mean, we're seeing a lot of blatant things going on, but this really was a slap in the face and in public.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we as an organization offered them a long-term agreement over, well, actually 11 years.
Which is unprecedented.
Through 2020, and because this all happened in 2009. So, you know, we gave them the safety net they wanted to, but yet they restated their position of wanting to punish people. So that's they got to live by what they said.
Yep.
So.
Again, good for you guys. And this is the reason that I always say it's why you should belong to a union, because without a union, there's no voice here. And this is.
But
just,
you know, we don't ask for things. I mean, just think about these people in some of these other states who aren't as strong. You know, they don't have the pensions, and you know, they don't have the health care coverage, and they don't have the education systems. I mean, you're talking. I believe South Carolina is at number 48.
Yes.
In education. I mean, so I'm sure that we have a lot of transplants going to South Carolina to do the work over there whenever the opportunity appears. But it's just sad, like you said, that we have to, you know, you have people who protest. You know, some of those people who are protesting against the people in Madison are the same people who enjoy Medicare and other benefits from Social Security, but they don't understand that this is a social contract that we have. And there's something to say about the greatness of America. And there are people in this country, and the Koch brothers and people like that, who think that if you're not a billionaire, you're just a lesser person. But they don't mind our sons and daughters defending democracy in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places in the world, protecting their assets. And there's something to be said about that.
I absolutely agree with you. And the last point before we go, you said, you know, that there's no sense, and I agree with this, that there's no sense in unions wanting to destroy jobs. In fact, you want the company to be prosperous. But the frame that I heard from the right is that these unions are just trying to destroy Boeing, which nothing could be further from the truth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We can point to time after time. Look, there's nothing that can't be settled by having things done at a table and being able to say whatever's on your mind to clear the air and solve problems. And successful people and successful groups and successful companies practice that in every day. And, you know, we're willing to do these things. We do it with the company today. We're going to do it tomorrow. This is a situation that eventually will be resolved. You know, it's not a situation we wanted to find ourselves in.
Yeah, I hear you. But at the end of the day, and I've said this a million times, unions don't benefit from companies going out of business. They only benefit when they're prosperous.
That's right.
Rich Michalski, I appreciate your time, General Vice President of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. I appreciate your time, brother.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
In case you missed it, America just celebrated its National Day of Irony, April 22nd. The irony is that this date is not only Earth Day, but also happens to be the day that BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig sank into the Gulf of Mexico 1 year ago. If a novelist or movie scriptwriter juxtaposed the date of a hellish environmental catastrophe with that of a day when thousands of Americans gathered to celebrate and promote environmental protection, the plot would be hooted down as a cheap attempt to manufacture drama. Reality, however, has a way of creating its own ironies, and the BP Earth Day convergence was not the only one of April 22nd. Just 1 week prior, the corporate-hugging House of Representatives chose to demonstrate its commitment to Earth's fragile ecology by passing the GOP's extremist budget plan. Included were provisions to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate corporations that emit the greenhouse gases causing today's disastrous climate changes. But that wasn't extreme enough. The plan also slashed EPA's budget, leaving our Earth and ourselves to the tender mercies of corporate self-regulation. That's not merely ironic, it's moronic. Meanwhile, BP itself says it wants to resume deepwater drilling in the Gulf, and highly publicized promises by the White House and Congress to tighten drilling rules are being stalled by industry lobbyists. Likewise, political pledges to stop the ecological blasphemy of mountaintop removal, confront the absurdity of natural gas fracking, deal with thousands of miles of leaking and exploding pipelines, respond to the dead zones in our oceans, do something about climate change, and address so many other environmental needs have been put on Washington's back burner. This is Jim Hightower saying, on this Earth Day, the irony is killing us.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think about this Boeing thing? Personally, I think this is the right decision, and I'll tell you why. For too long, what has gone on in this country is corporations have been able to use the threat of you of moving to one of the 22 right-to-work states. Well, you know, we'll just go to one of those states where unions, they're not so strong. Now, understand what a right-to-work state is. It's basically a state that says, you know, unions, you can exist, but we the government, we the state government, we the power of the gun, we're going to tell you and that employer that you cannot come to an agreement or a security clause. You cannot make an agreement between the two of you because we don't trust the two of you. You know, we don't believe in your freedom to negotiate and make an agreement. We don't believe in that. That's basically what it is. And that's what they want to do here in Pennsylvania. They want to be able to tell an employer and the employee that you cannot bargain for a security clause. Can't do it. Because I don't think most people understand how a negotiation works in a contract. That's one of the first things you negotiate. You say, you know what? We want to close. We want a shop where everybody is in the bargaining unit. Where the people here are paying for the administration of the contract. Everybody's a part of the union. It makes for a cohesive workplace. And, you know, to be honest, it also helps the company with some of their human resource problems. So if you've got a problem employee, and oh, look, I was a steward for years. A company would come, we got a problem with this guy. Can you talk to him? It was a two-way street because at the end of the day, it was about making the company profitable. It was about keeping them in business long enough so that you could retire from there. There's a lot of rhetoric running around in the right-wing circles that, well, you know, these union thugs, they just want to put these companies out of business because they don't like them. Think about that on a logical plane. So when you look at this decision, and I think Rich Michalski came out with a bunch of information. The state of Washington gave $3.2 billion in economic development money to build that second line. And what you got is you've got the higher up saying, well, you know what, we're going to go over to South Carolina because they're offering some money. They've got an exploitable workforce. We can go over there. We can pit them against each other. And you look at the fact that we have such screwed up laws in this country when it comes to labor, that we don't really have a cohesive policy. We don't have a cohesive framework. We've got 50 individual sets of laws. And there are some, you know, there are some who believe that the Constitution of this country is nothing more than an economic treaty. It's a treaty amongst the states to agree on some things, but at the end of the day, we're 50 individual countries who have agreed on some certain things of trading. And that's it. I don't believe that. I believe we're one nation. I mean, when I was a kid, they pounded into me, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And they love throwing that out there in the patriotic days. And yes, I repeated ad nauseum. I regurgitated at command. But do I know what it means? One nation, indivisible, liberty, justice for all. So what we've got are people on one side who believe, you know what, this is just a big free trade zone. Corporations can come and go as they please, and if they can pit one state against another state, so much better for them. If we can pit a state that's struggling like Ohio against a state like Indiana who's struggling, so much better for the corporation. The company wins. The profiteers win. If we can get Ohio to take $1.4 billion and hand it over to the corporations, stealing it from education, that's a good thing. I'm not one of those people. I'm not one of those people who say, you know, Tom Corbett's doing the right thing by stealing from the future of this country to hand out money to the drillers and to the people who want to see their profits leave the state of Pennsylvania through the Delaware loophole. I'm not one of those people, man. And this decision is important because it says, you know what? For all of your, not to overuse the word thuggery, corporations have it too good. They have too much power. They're saying, you know what? You can't rub their faces in it anymore. We're not going to let you threaten those people. We're not going to let you do it. We're not going to let you take their rights in public away. Remember Leona Helmsley? The other reason she went to jail is because she was blatant about it. She came right out and said, well, you know what? Rich people don't pay taxes. That's why we got lawyers. That's why we've got accountants. We don't have to pay any of that stuff. It's poor people who do that. And this is the Boeing situation. They were out in public saying what they were saying in their boardrooms, which is why the Republican Party's having so much trouble right now, I think. All of those things they whispered to each other like giddy little schoolgirls in the cloakroom. All those things they whispered in the think tanks at the Heritage Foundation. They're now emboldened to say in public, and people are waking up and going, well, that's not what you said on the campaign trail. I didn't know the Republican Party stood for that. It's the same thing here. The National Labor Relations Board, the General Counsel, looked at this and said, you know what? This is over the line. It's way over the line. And it's about time that our government protect we, the working people. And I hear people say, well, you know, I want politicians to do the work of the people. And I always ask, which people? For years, the National Labor Relations Board was doing the work of the corporations, doing the work of the CEO. Now that you've got somebody who's looking into it and saying, maybe we should take a fair and balanced approach, that the law says workers have the right to join and form unions, workers have the right to collective bargaining, workers have the right to strike, when a corporation says we're going to deny you of those rights, and this is the action we're going to take to deny you of those rights, the NLRB steps in and says, you know what? You can't do that. That's what gets me. And that's why I think this is the right decision. This is absolutely the right decision at the right time. This idea that we can allow a company to, you know, to say in your face that we're moving somewhere else and there's nothing you can do about it. To me, at some point, somebody's got to put their foot down. And I'm glad they did. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children in Need Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My cases are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
Big news out of the Supreme Court today.
Very interesting. Yes, the Supreme Court today turned down Virginia's request that the Supreme Court rule immediately on the constitutionality of the nation's health care overhaul. Virginia's Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli said, look, we need it done now. Because, you know, there's a palpable consensus in the country that it has to be done now. But the Obama administration said, look, the individual mandate doesn't take effect till 2014, and the justices would benefit from reviews from lower courts. And the justices really didn't comment. They just came back with their decision. And this is pretty usual, actually.
Okay.
It's very rare. I mean, if you had aliens floating overhead with guns, you know, pointed down at us, maybe. But other than that, they really don't tend to make these decisions.
Because I was going to ask, can we read anything into this that maybe they won't take it down the road either?
No, I don't think we can read anything into it at all. Now, one interesting piece about it is that Justice Elena Kagan participated in the decision, and conservative critics of the law had suggested that she might have to sit out review of it because of her role as Obama's first Solicitor General. But she did say in her confirmation hearing that she took part in only the most minor of discussions about the health care law.
So she wasn't involved in the intricacies, if you will.
Right.
Well, we will see when that comes around. Also, more information on the Republicans going after the Defense of Marriage Act?
Well, this is just a weird story. I mean, it can get very arcane, but it's fascinating because, the Obama administration said, look, we're not going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act, which basically says marriage between a man and a woman anymore, because we believe that this law is unconstitutional, Justice Department said. And so the House Republicans said, okay, then we will defend it ourselves. So they hired a law firm called King & Spalding and former Solicitor General under George Bush, Paul Clement, to do it last week, April 18th.
For an awful lot of money.
An awful lot of money. I mean, you know, like $500,000. And there are about 10 cases pending. So surprisingly, today, King & Spalding said, no, we are not going to do this.
Wow, so they bailed on over $500,000.
Yes.
I wonder what that means.
Well, it's very interesting to know what it means, actually. Nobody's entirely sure, except it's starting to become clear. And what was also interesting at the same time was that Paul Clement, who was the attorney in the case, said, well, you know, I'm going to continue with the case because I have a duty to my client, even if the client is, in fact, an unpopular client. So I'm leaving the firm, he said this morning, and he quit the firm. So that was a big deal.
Well, and now, he's going to take a big payday with him.
That's right. And then later today, he joined another firm, which took it on. And then it started to emerge during the course of the day that King & Spalding, one of their top clients is Coca-Cola, which is based in Atlanta like them, directly intervened to press the firm to extricate itself from the case.
Aha! And now we find out what the real story is.
Yeah.
Or as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story.
Yes. Coca-Cola has a long public history of support for equality and diversity. And King & Spalding has a long support for equality and diversity also. And King & Spalding was also facing escalating protests from gay rights groups.
Interesting.
So basically it came under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, at the end of it, you know, I'm sure Coke exerted enough pressure to made him go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of money he's going to make over this as well. The oil subsidies craze is going to be going on.
Yeah, this is very interesting. What we're going to see coming up in May, basically, is you're going to see the Republicans and Democrats fight each other out over oil prices. It's already started. In fact, the White House today says that oil firms' subsidies are crazy amid corporate profits. Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, said, I think most Americans would agree with the president that it's simply crazy and unsustainable to continue to subsidize the oil and gas companies when we need to reduce our deficit and invest elsewhere.
Duh.
Right. And I think, you know, many Americans agree with that. And he said, you know, it's great to make a profit, but basically not for Americans to have to subsidize those profits is what he went on to say. And that is going to be the Democrats' thrust in May. On the other hand, the Republicans' thrust is basically going to be that we need to look for more energy, and they're going to be also introducing bills, having hearings, having markups.
Yeah, so it's basically the Republicans are going to be the drill baby drill people, and Democrats are going to stand there and go, well, our hands are tied because the Republicans are these recalcitrant babies who won't let us do anything else. We should be moving full head of steam on rail, on public transportation, on alternative energy, to amounts that we've never seen before. But that's not going to happen until we hit that squeal point. And I don't know what that squeal point is.
I don't know what it is either. And I think that's, I don't think we've reached that point yet, and I don't think that Americans necessarily know what that is either.
Is it seven? Is it eight? Is it $10 a gallon? What's that squeal point to where people like in our community, you know, will start begging for public transportation?
I don't know. I mean, it's $9 a gallon gas in England, and, well, they take a lot of public transportation. I mean, you know, there's this famous Exxon station in Washington, D.C., the Exxon at the Watergate. There's another one, Exxon at Democracy Boulevard, which is a couple of miles from me. But the Exxon at the Watergate is the single most expensive gas station in Washington. Nobody knows why, but it's $4.99 for regular right now.
Wow, $4.99?
It's $4.99 for regular. And, you know, nobody yet goes there except people who get caught short.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, to be honest, in driving around Washington, D.C., there aren't an awful lot of gas stations. So it's they got you by the short hairs.
They've got you. They've absolutely got you. And you can find yourself there suddenly realizing you're about to leave the city for a trip through Virginia and you don't know when the next gas station
is. And you're going to get fleeced.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Yeah, that is what capitalism is all about. And lastly, the whole rage over the town hall rage over the Medicare, which I guess everybody had to know was coming, and even our T-Twizzler friends had to go out there and know that they were going to get beat up over Ryan's proposal to end Medicare.
Yeah, this has been really fascinating. I mean, House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan himself got booed at his own town hall last week.
And good for him.
Yeah, as he tried to defend the changes to Medicare, shall we put it that way. As you know, the Republicans voted on their budget just before they went into recess, and it involved major changes to Medicare, particularly for those 55 and under, but also for those older. And a lot of seniors are up in arms about this. But it's not just seniors, it's other people too. And the seniors are not just outraged about what they see as changes to seniors. Republicans had bet that seniors would not be too upset because the changes are not going to impact them. But seniors are saying, we don't want this to happen to our children either.
Yeah, and I think the Republicans were taken by that as Republican Alan Simpson loves to say, those greedy geezers. I think he thought the greedy geezers were going to say, I got it for me and I don't care about anybody else.
Right, and it didn't quite work out like that. So what's happening now is that liberal groups and Democratic groups have been capitalizing on this, particularly with advertising campaigns, and are really going to town. Meantime, House Republican leadership has convened a conference call for tomorrow for House members so that they can strategize over ways for members to respond to this rage so that they can try to find a way to justify this vote. And that's not going to be particularly easy.
I think the only way they're going to do it is what Republicans do a really good job of, which is vetting the people sitting in the seats, making sure that nobody who disagrees with you gets in.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's the end game. That will be the main talking point. Anyway, Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Thank you very much indeed.
All righty, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. And we're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Wants me to give my money to someone like you. But I do believe in what a great man can do.
Scott Right Wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm David Thillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Time will change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, You can download it there at our site at thericksmithshow.com. The podcast is there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, and convenience. Also, if you want to contact me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. I saw this piece in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review that caught my attention. It said, the headline read, "Conservative Wave Seems to Miss Pennsylvania." And I got to be honest, I kind of like this frame from a, you know, a messaging standpoint. The Republicans, again, are masters at manipulating the media, at spinning things, framing things. They're masters at it. They're out there saying, well, you know, we're not as radical. We're not as far out on the fringe as Wisconsin or Ohio or Maine or New Hampshire or you know, Indiana or any of the other states that have gone the extreme route. We're more pragmatic. We're more middle Republicans. And I go, really? I seem to be missing something here. Didn't our governor follow some of the same things that Kasich in Ohio has done and Walker in Wisconsin has done, basically ending the state's basic health insurance program, basically just ending adult basic like they did the Badger Care in Wisconsin? Didn't isn't that the same thing? Oh, never mind. Maybe he's not as extreme there. It's not that he kicked 42,000 people off the rolls, and there were hundreds of thousands more who want to be on it and need some measure of health insurance. People who work for a living. Understand that. This very basic plan were for people who work for a living. So they go on and they say, well, you know, in other areas, you know, unencumbered by Democrats, they passed such legislation expanding gun rights, immigration laws, school vouchers, curtailing abortion rights, and jobless and post-retirement benefits. They go on to even say some legislatures are debating plans to require photo identification for voters at polling places and proof that presidential candidates are natural-born citizens. See how crazy they are? Yet, let's stop and take a second and think about something that the Pennsylvania Republicans are pushing for. They want to privatize the state wine and spirit shops. They want to hock off to the lowest bidder, the liquor stores. Something that generates a good amount of revenue for the state every year, year in, year out. They want to hock that off to the lowest bidder. They've already privatized part of the Port Authority in Allegheny County in the public transportation area. They've already hocked off part of that. And of course, the most profitable runs for the profiteers. Let you, the taxpayer, pay for that unprofitable stuff. But the profiteers, they'll get the good stuff. Let me think, you know, the fact that we haven't taxed any of the Marcellus Shale gas drillers, haven't done that, haven't closed the Delaware loophole. They're talking about these vouchers and they've expanded the use of lethal force outside the home. Again, you know, these are the right-wing talking points. Yet somehow they want us to believe that, you know, Pennsylvanians, the Pennsylvania Republicans, aren't nearly as extreme. Because the reality is, I think the Republican Party understands that the Tea Party didn't really take hold here. There are a few Tea Twizzlers walking around, but you didn't see that mass push. You saw a very moderate state swing to the right, yes, but not for the insaniacs. But I find it interesting, this whole frame. And the one professor that they quoted from Washington and Jefferson College said, politically, we're not as volatile. We don't have as much extremism in Pennsylvania. And there are no agendas or contracts to make radical changes. We're more pragmatic. He goes on to say that Corbett embodies that as a leader. Really? Remind me in several years when my children go to college, Washington and Jefferson, not a place I want them to go. I'm just amazed because, you know, all of the things that we've been talking about seem to me to be pretty radical. Cutting $1 billion from education seems to me to be pretty radical. cutting 56% of the higher education budget. Radical. Kicking people off of health care. Radical. Hocking off the state assets. Doing away, privatizing what is the commons of this state. You know, of the commonwealth. To me, is radical. And in the coming month, we're going to be talking about unemployment compensation. And again, a guy who came out and said, look, people are basically lazy. They've got it too good. They want to sit home and collect their check. To me, seems kind of radical. And you look at this piece by the folks over at Boston University's Sloan Center on Aging and Work. They report 1 in 8 older adults among the long-term unemployed, saying, quote, among unemployed adults over the age of 65, 1 out of 8, 12 and a little over 12%, had faced 99 weeks or more of unemployment, sometimes called very long-term unemployment. For the unemployed adults 55 plus, they were 11.5%. They had spent the better part of 2 years looking for work, considerably higher than the figure of 6% among unemployed workers under the age of 35, when you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data of 2011. We're going to be debating this whole unemployment compensation system. And what we've seen other states do, and you know, I'm kind of thinking that the Republicans here are going to try and do the same thing. What we have seen them do is, well, let's lower the number of weeks. Michigan went from 26 down to 20. If we do that here, if we don't do something here, we're going to have thousands more people off of the rolls, which means higher unemployment rate, which means less economic activity in the state, which means, I think, problems. So in the coming days, we're going to be talking to people who are up on the issue. We're going to work very hard at coming up with a solution to the problem, not just pointing out that we have a problem, but coming out with a solution for it. Anyway, our stat of the week comes from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog. They say over half of the income that goes to America's most affluent 1%, over half, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning tax analyst David K. Johnston, goes to the top one-tenth of 1%. That is the richest 1 out of every 1,000 families. For every $1 that goes to the top 1%, for every $1 in 1980 that went to the top 1%, they now make 4. Stop and think about that. I mean, that, how do I get that kind of a return? Anyway, some quick stories that I've got on my desk. You got to love the folks who call themselves, the values people. This guy cracks me up. Republican Robert Watson, the House Minority Leader in Rhode Island, evidently one of the folks who criticized, people who smoke pots and immigrants and this whole nine yards. In fact, what he said was kind of, one of these things that I think comes off the cuff that probably not the best thing to say. But he was talking about gay immigrants who smoke pot, and that's how far off the path that the House is. It's like, quote, if you are a Guatemalan gay man who likes to gamble and smoke marijuana, that's where he thought things were at. Anyway, on Friday, he got pulled over in a checkpoint. Turns out, smoking pot. He was arrested for possession of marijuana and drug paraphernalia and driving under the influence. He was released on a $500 bond. But again, I think his political career there, not long for this world. I remember a while ago we talked about the guy from Wisconsin who, he senator there. He was, one of the key people, wanting to steal the collective bargaining rights away. Turns out, family values guy living in another area with his mistress, wasn't home with his wife where he should have been. He was living somewhere else with his 25-year-old mistress. You remember he put out this ad that said, call me and, call this number. And it turns out that it was one of those sex lines. Remember him? I guess it isn't going to work. Anyway, I find out that an interesting story in the New York Times that porn companies have been amassing these 1-800 numbers for quite a time. So all of those 1-800 numbers that you used to call with any 1-800 call me or 1-800 do this or 1-800 jump off the bridge, whatever, are now going to these sex lines. So I guess in keeping up with him, in giving him a break, which I'm not really willing to do, could happen to anybody. In fact, you call 1-800 Chicago. Instead of reaching the tourism hotline for the Windy City, you'll hear a woman offering one-on-one talk with a nasty girl. Kind of the exact same thing that was done there. 1-800 Metallica, 1-800 Cadillac, 1-800 Minolta, 1-800 Cameras, my favorite, 1-800 Worship, and 1-800 Whirlpool. Although I could see that being a porn site. Maybe not. But anyway, they're buying all this stuff up. And causing some chaos, especially for our friend there in Wisconsin who decided to cite the wrong number, got himself into a little more trouble than even he was expecting. I look at that Wisconsin thing. I got to be honest, I'm happy to see that they've gotten so many of those guys recalled. It's going to be interesting to see how it turns out. In fact, they're already planning to recall Walker. And Feingold is, talking about running for governor. So that should be an interesting pairing in a couple of months to look forward to. Anyway, today in labor history, another reason why I never really was a big fan of the New York Times, today they declared the struggle for an 8-hour workday to be un-American and calls the public demonstrations that happened, all of the people taking to the streets for shorter hours, they called those labor disturbances brought on by foreigners. Other publications declared that the 8-hour workday would bring about loafing and gambling, rioting, debauchery, and drunkenness. The year was 1886. The Times again, doing their thing. Bought and paid for. On this day back in 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that employers may not require female employees to make larger contributions to pension plans in order to have the same benefits as men. But you know what? All of that stuff would have happened anyway without the feminist movement, without labor unions. All would have happened anyway. It was just like Phyllis Schlafly says. It's capitalism. Capitalism. Anyway, the Harrisburg Senators had a great promotional thing this evening. Last week we talked about the fact that there was no water in Harrisburg because of a main break. And who was the culprit, you ask? Years of neglect? No. It was the Beavers. Leave it to Beaver. So to honor the hardworking little critter, the Senators offered free box seats to anybody with the last name of Beaver or anyone who lived in Beaver, PA. Anyone with the name of Cleaver, kind of pay homage to the Leave It to Beaver show, they got in free. And also people who had the names Theodore, June, Ward, and Wally, they got discounted tickets. So, good for them. To be honest, Theodore, June, Ward, and Wally, they should get discounted tickets no matter what time of year it is. Anyway, I want to thank all of our guests for being here. Thank you for listening in. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast. It is there for your entertainment and enjoyment as well as your convenience. I want to thank our board op, Brett, for keeping everything sounding great and moving the sliders and answering the phone. Again, thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.